You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Barbara Wien. She teaches gender, global security, and peace education at American University. Since 1981, she has worked to strengthen grassroots civil society networks for peace and democracy in 58 countries. She has led 8 national nonprofit organizations, taught at 6 universities, and helped spark the development of 200 university peace studies programs. She's the author, editor of 23 publications in gender, economics, and nonviolence. She's protected civilians from death squads using nonviolent strategies for Peace Brigades International. She was recognized for her leadership and moral courage for denouncing the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq as a U.S. government official. Barbara Wien, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming on. I understand you were just part of this march to protest the work of the NRA. Can you recount what happened there?
Absolutely, yes. Over 1,000 people marched from Fairfax, Virginia, at the headquarters of the National Rifle Association to the Department of Justice, about 17 miles, because we believe that we must respond to conflict with skills. We must respond to violence with skills, not more guns. And too many young people are losing their lives, too many police officers, school children, young African Americans in the United States. And we said, enough, stop. And it was a beautiful display of solidarity and strategic partnerships. It was largely young people who led the march, young people of color, and moms who demand action for sensible gun laws in the United States. So to see that kind of coalition was very inspiring. We marched in 106-degree heat in very high humidity. We were hit by thunderstorms in the afternoon. But the spirit was beautiful, and we will persist, and we are not deterred by bullying. And we have spoke plainly and clearly to the press. We got great press in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and all major network news.
Well, I hope it makes an impression on members of Congress that they haven't been paid enough not to hear, because they need to hear it.
Yes, unfortunately, there is an iron triangle between the gun manufacturers, those who are profiting from all the violence, Smith and Beretta and all the big gun makers. They have a very, very strong relationship with the National Rifle Association. In fact, they are the board of the NRA. And then the NRA then helps fund the campaigns of members of Congress. So it is a reinforcing iron triangle, not unlike the major weapons producers for military spending and war making. Those that produce the weapons then fund lobbying groups like the National Rifle Association, and that NRA then ensures the reelection of elected officials and members of Congress. We have to carve off the edges of that iron triangle with nonviolence, peace education, grassroots movements, and social media. Dot kinds of things like radio, television, Twitter, Facebook, and all the other social media that young people are using now to raise consciousness. We've got to transform that iron triangle into a peacemaking circle.
Absolutely. This is something I wanted to ask you about with peace studies in particular, because it seems like peace activism in terms of opposing wars, not opposing domestic gun violence or domestic violence in homes or violent cultures in our schools and communities, but actually trying to end wars. There seems to be quite a chasm between that and peace studies in universities, where mostly what I hear about is the sort of things you hear about from the U.S. Institute of Peace. You know, how can we provide aid in those poor nations around the world that the United States is not bombing at the moment? Or, you know, is there a gap as I'm perceiving it, or is peace studies really studying how to end war?
Well, there's a spectrum, and these things are interrelated. There's a continuum of violence, as you said, starting at the very germicidal level, the very granular level in the home, all the way up to nuclear weapons. So peace education must begin with the smallest children, with the youngest children, to teach creative responses to conflict and unleash our imagination about how we can live together through transforming consciousness, attitudes, skills, behavior, and then scaling up all along the continuum of human existence to looking at intergroup relations, intercommunal relations, societal relations, the way we design our programs, policies, public institutions, and then, of course, all the way up to the international level, how can nations form cooperative relationships? The whole vision of peace education and peace studies is to transform the way that the world deals with conflict, away from adversarial approaches and militarized approaches, towards cooperative solutions. And so the first theory of change that peace education embraces is to develop a critical mass of individuals by investing in education, youth training, personal transformation, consciousness raising, workshops, dialogues, encounter groups, trauma healing. And there you begin to demonstrate to people that conflict resolution actually can work. They see it in their everyday lives. They see concrete examples of it, and they are much more convinced of the evidence. I think if we start off sometimes with distant issues of foreign affairs, we will lose people. So often when I've worked with rural communities and very disenfranchised communities, rural poor, or I work with community college students who are largely blue-collar workers, middle to low-income folks, I don't necessarily always start off with ending war. I start off with meal ticket issues at the local level and show them the trade-offs that exist between mass military spending and how that money could be used to reinvest into human needs in their local community. Into job training and green energy and education and healthcare. And that really shifts their framework, their paradigm. But we must go on to look at healthy relationships and all the connections, breaking out of isolation and polarization and division and prejudice and stereotypes among groups. We have to look at strong trust building and relationship building. And there you really get into more the intergroup work and the networking and the coalition building and joint efforts on substantive problems. This is what I've done with displaced communities of laid-off timber workers in the Pacific Northwest or Rust Belt workers in the Midwest or folks in the rural South. We come together and we teach large-scale facilitation, problem-solving, conflict analysis. Okay, you've got major problems, structural problems in your community. Why turn against each other? Or why turn against immigrants or blacks or liberals or environmentalists? Why don't we come together as a community and solve this and begin the process of critical analysis? what could be alternative jobs? How could we come together to generate green jobs, which actually employs 10 times the number of people as some of these poisonous, polluting industries? But then we have to get to deeper underlying issues of injustice, oppression, exploitation, class differences, identity politics, if you will, and people's sense of injury and victimization. So there we have to do large-scale, long-term campaigns for social and structural change, truth and reconciliation, changing institutions, laws, regulations, and particularly the economic system, which pits people against each other in a race to the bottom increasingly, and, you know, reframing the whole question of globalization. And then peace studies must begin to look at how do we mobilize people in opposition to war? How do we get political leaders to pay attention? And there you have to mobilize the grassroots to advocate for positive action using the media, nonviolent direct action campaigns, boycotts, sanctions, divestment, organizing advocacy groups, dramatic events to raise consciousness. And there are so many creative campaigns around the world now. And you can go to the website Beautiful Rising or read the book Beautiful Trouble, which chronicles and documents the rise of so many nonviolent struggles and campaigns around the world. And then we have to shift public attitudes. War and violence are deeply ingrained in people's misperceptions and intolerance of difference, and they have only been fed a steady diet of violence as a solution to things. They think that militarism and war is the way to protect themselves. We have to vastly transform public attitudes to show that war does not make us safer. War actually creates the very threats we seek to avoid. So all of these things are interconnected, and peace education studies have shown that when you institute peaceful attitudes and cooperative lesson plans in schools at the youngest grade, people will not turn against each other during times of adversity. We've done meta-analysis of all long-term peace education studies now over the last 70 years. I've been collecting them from around the world, from Indonesia to Chile to Canada, New Zealand, you know, all over the world. We have peace education studies in Africa. And it shows that when extremists come into the community, if there's been peace education instituted in the schools, it inoculates and vaccinates populations against hate. And they're much more likely to band together to resist violence and to try to transform the negative influences in their community into positive action.
Barbara Wien, I am still struck by the fact that the biggest force financially in our country, the war profiteers, the weapons dealers, are not just major, major funders of election campaigns. They're major funders of our universities. Maybe I'm just cynical, but I run into so many U.S. academics who study war as something produced by dark-skinned places anywhere other than the U.S., or genocide studies as, you know, studying war created by non-U.S., non-Western people. Steven Pinker and these types who have, you know, declared war virtually over by blinding themselves to any U.S. wars and looking at only non-U.S. wars as the sum total of war in the world. I'm wondering what percentage of peace studies courses do you think are opposing U.S. war making?
Oh, I would say the overwhelming majority of them are. Now, there are different faces of conflict resolution courses that mostly deal with intergroup dynamics and don't necessarily take on the institution of war. But in the Peace and Justice Studies Association, I would say the preponderance of the programs I've worked with over the years really see war as the enemy, war as a system. We have to take on the war system. Of course, the United States is not the only one perpetuating war at this time, and there are tyrannical governments around the world that are waging war against their own people. But, yes, we are the largest purveyor of violence on the planet. At this point, we outstrip all of our adversaries by a magnitude of, you know, 5 times in military spending. The levels of U.S. military spending are obscene, and we are, you know, completely unaffordable, unsustainable. And we're beginning to see the effects of that in the United States very, very deeply. With the lack of health care and jobs and the infrastructure crumbling, the National Association of Civil Engineers says it's going to take about $6 to $11 trillion to repair all of the bridges, railroads, and infrastructure in the United States, the sewage systems. That's how much we've spent on the Iraq and Afghan wars combined over the last 15 years. So it completely mirrors the expenditures on war that we need to sustain the health and vitality of our country. So the U.S. is, you know, really the leader of the pack in terms of militarism and war spending. But, of course, we are not the only ones, and the glorification of war is still quite prominent in other countries. So peace studies takes on the whole institution of war. We look at the roots of war. If you dissect or deconstruct the textbooks that are used in peace studies, we look at psychological attitudes. We look at economic systems that make war profitable. We look at, you know, the whole adrenaline rush that some people get from war and war fighting. We look at patriarchy, how men's power to dominate and rule also takes on many different forms of violence that leads to mass rape and gender-based violence. So we look at the, you know, asymmetry between male and female representation around the world. So we look at about 10 or 12 major roots of violence in the world that need to be transformed and rooted out. But there are those programs that shy away from really critiquing U.S. government policies or U.S. foreign policies. They don't take on the question of arms sales and who's profiting at the greed and the military-industrial complex. Some programs, I would say, are really security studies programs. They're not considered peace studies programs. Or they shy away from taking on the institution of war itself. They've kind of watered down peace studies from its original origins. And they largely look at intergroup relations and dialogue.
I was expecting you from our previous conversations to talk about that problem as being ubiquitous. It sounds like you're describing it as a minority of the programs out there.
Yeah, if we do a survey of the justice and peace studies programs, I would say that probably about 20 to 30% of them are just looking at conflict resolution skills, processes, attitudes, you know, how to get people to the negotiating table, what are comparative peace truces, and, you know, where have we've been successful in ending wars, what were the conditions around that. Not enough of them also look at the role of grassroots women's coalitions in bringing that about. Gender is sorely missing from a lot of them. But I would say probably about 60% of or 70% of the programs I've worked with at the undergraduate level have taken on questions of war, militarism, military spending. Now, there is this, you know, tendency or notion that you really have to professionalize peace studies at the graduate level. So they have to come away with marketable skills if they've spent all this money on a master's degree. or a PhD, then they have to be able to go out and, you know, work in government agencies or the Foreign Service or the United Nations, or in refugee camps rehabilitating child soldiers, or, you know, trying to strengthen community resilience against violence at the grassroots level. So there you will have, you know, more clinical approaches, more monitoring and evaluation, and less of a critique of U.S. government policy. So I would distinguish between a lot of the undergraduate programs and the master's degrees. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah. So if the peace movement groups that I work with get more money and more jobs to offer, maybe there will be more education of students to fill those jobs.
Absolutely. And we are finding that a lot of our graduates at American University in the master's program in international peace and conflict resolution have also turned their skills inward domestically. So they've become violence interrupters in their communities. They're working with gangs in South Central Los Angeles. They established one of the first academies for nonviolence among Crips and Bloods. And these young people that are former members of gangs are channeling and organizing, galvanizing, and mobilizing their populations against police violence, trying to create safe streets, jobs, going back to a lot of the roots of what the Black Panthers were trying to do, breakfast programs and, you know, creating cooperative networks for economics in South Central Los Angeles. We're seeing that increasingly in Detroit. There is a co-op like that, a People's Resistance Collective here at the Peace House in Washington, D.C., led by African-American young people. So they're fanning out and doing water distribution among the homeless on hot days in D.C. They have a free clothing collective, housing, and we're building up networks of those across the country to offer an alternative to the predatory economic models. There's more and more, cooperative banks and land trusts and back to the land movement and housing cooperatives, co-housing and communal forms of support. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance, farm cooperatives. People are seeing the links between violent economics and also militarism at the international level.
Yeah.
So they're trying to de-link from the dominant economic institutions and create grassroots alternatives. Gandhi always said, you know, you have to have the obstructive program to resist evil and war, but you also have to have the constructive program. More importantly, more paramount to begin to build alternative economic institutions while you're dismantling the old ones.
Yes, a very important point. We've got just a few minutes left. Barbara Wien, I wanted to ask you briefly about workshops you've been doing for federal employees and the fact that you were among those arrested protesting the inauguration of Donald Trump and find out the status of that.
Well, the resistance against tyranny is very, very deep and very, very broad in the United States. We haven't even begun to get a sense of how deep and broad it really is, and it takes on many, many faces. So, one of the biggest networks of resistance I have worked with are synagogues and churches. That are over 300 strong in the Maryland, Virginia district area, where they are actually supporting and housing and sheltering those immigrants who feel at risk, whose families are being ripped apart. And we have rapid response networks set up. We have phone trees. People go down to Farmville in Virginia, where immigrants are being detained. And we circle the prison there and sing and hold the space for immigrant families who are so fearful and whose children are so at risk. But then we have hundreds and thousands of federal workers who are examining their role in resisting unconstitutional and illegal orders within their government agencies. So we've held a series of workshops called Resist, Retreat, or Resign, so that government workers can learn what are your rights in the workplace, what is federally protected, how can the American Federation of Government Employees protect you, what are you allowed to do in the workplace that is, you know, respectable and allowable within the limits of the Hatch Act. And federal employees do have First Amendment rights, and they are allowed to voice their opinions and be part of political campaigns. They just can't do it on government time, on the government dime. And so many people are looking at the rules, regulations, and laws within, you know, the EPA, the National Institutes of Health, the State Department, the Defense Department, Homeland Security, and saying, no, I'm not going to carry out orders that violate the Constitution, and there are laws that protect civil servants in this way. And I consider that the highest form of patriotism, because they took an oath of office to the Constitution, not to a political party or to a president. They were sworn into office to uphold the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. So it's very important that they're respecting those democratic rules. And then, of course, there are many other forms of resistance that are happening on college campuses, in the women's movements, in inner cities, with governors, the National League of Cities, and so many others I can't even begin to report on. But we did march with Native Americans, environmental groups, women's groups, peace groups on the day of Trump's inauguration, because we felt that the Trump regime, was not legitimately elected. We felt that we really had a coup d'etat in America in November because of all the gerrymandering that's happened around the country. A lot of people were shut out of voting. We estimate that 36,000 students in the state of Kansas were not allowed to vote because they couldn't produce a birth certificate. About 300,000 Hispanics were disenfranchised in Texas. And on and on and on, people's election districts
Barbara,
were
with,
marked up.
Barbara, with 20 seconds left, are you still facing charges for that arrest?
I am not, but there are young people who have been falsely accused of felony rioting. So the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the D.C. police for wrongful arrest. And that trial will begin later this year, 280 young people who were peacefully protesting were rounded up through trap and detain and falsely accused of felony rioting. So I've been trying to offer court support, and there are many of us that are involved in trying to reverse those charges against them.
Those people need our support, and all of the wonderful work that you are doing, Barbara Wien, needs our support. And I'm looking forward to seeing you at a conference at American University that World Beyond War is planning for September 22nd to 24th that people can find at worldbeyondwar.org. Barbara Wien, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me. Keep up the good work yourself. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time. We'll be right back.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, media are celebrating the participation of Afghan girls in a robotics competition in D.C. after being denied visas twice as somehow a feel-good story about America. No one seems to have pondered the irony of the denials, given that Afghan girls doing science is precisely the sort of PR moment the U.S. pretended the 2001 invasion was all about. It could have opened a talk about what decades of unending war on Afghanistan have actually done towards that ostensible goal, but it did not. Counterspin discussed the war as feminist storyline with author, activist, and radio host Sonali Kolhatkar back in 2010. We'll hear that conversation again on today's show. U.S. lawmakers pushing for a new branch of the military focused on deploying extraterrestrial power is a real thing that is happening. A recent article on the website Quartz explained that while the plans are unlikely, they do send the message that the U.S. is concerned about the orbital military aspirations of rivals like China and Russia. Dystopian? Yes. Absurdly dangerous? You bet. But new, the idea isn't. In fact, Counterspin talked with journalism professor and author Carl Grossman about the weaponization of space in May of 2005. We'll hear that today as well. And finally, it's no surprise that healthcare continues to be front page news. It is disheartening, though, how little the conversation has changed in terms of the limits of what's considered possible. Corporate media have an outsized role in constraining that conversation. Producer and author T.R. Reid discovered just how resistant to expanding the conversation media can be. He told his story to Counterspin in April of 2009. Afghan women, weapons in space, and media's narrow healthcare debate. Three old topics that are new again this week on Counterspin. First up, Sonali Kolhatkar, interviewed in 2010 by Counterspin's Peter Hart.
As the U.S. war in Afghanistan began, the cover of Time magazine on December 3, 2001 announced, "Lifting the Veil, the shocking story of how the Taliban brutalized the women of Afghanistan. How much better will their lives be now?" Almost nine bloody years later, with the war grinding on, the cover of Time magazine features a disfigured Afghan woman and the text, "What happens if we leave Afghanistan?" The political context for both of these statements is fairly clear. One, a hopeful signal that the war has been launched to liberate women in Afghanistan. And now, more recently, this week's Time comes amidst growing doubts about that war and the release of tens of thousands of classified documents that portray the violence and confusion of the U.S. war. As the Obama White House tries to craft a coherent defense of the war amidst talk of timelines and benchmarks, Time magazine is signaling that the original defense of the war should still hold up. But does their argument make sense? Sonali Kolhatkar is host of the radio program Uprising, based at KPFK in Los Angeles. She's co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission and co-author of the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. Sonali, welcome back to Counterspin.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
Well, we're probably beyond the point of asking how people felt when they saw this Time cover. The intent is so obvious, and their editorial explanations suggest little in the way of nuance. Why Time did this is clear, as their managing editor Richard Stengel explained when he was on NBC's Chris Matthews show, quote, "What we have brought to that country was freedom for women in a way that they'd never had before. Girls are going to school, women are in parliament, women are on television," close quote. The flip side, obviously, is that women are brutalized by the Taliban, and thus we must stay in Afghanistan. What do you think when you hear comments like Stengel's and see this cover story in Time magazine?
Reality is much more nuanced than what most people like to admit. First of all, what Stengel says about us bringing freedom to Afghan women is ludicrous. There are a few things that Afghan women did gain as a result of the U.S. defeat of the Taliban, and most of those were on paper. They were constitutional. There are now quotas in the government for women's representation, and even a line in the Constitution that says women are equal to men. But also in the Constitution is the line that Islamic Sharia law is the supreme law of the land, and that was done in order to appease the U.S.'s Taliban-like friends, who are just as misogynist as the Taliban. And what neither Time nor what many of these mainstream reporters admit, as well as members of the Obama and before that Bush administration admit, is that when it comes to women's rights, as long as they're our friends, it doesn't matter if we undermine women's rights with the empowerment of misogynist warlords. We create this distinction between misogynists who are enemies and misogynists who are friends. But to Afghan women, there is no difference. For example, in today's Afghanistan, under U.S. occupation, there are record numbers of women in prison, languishing in prison for these so-called honor crimes that have been put there by judges appointed by our guy, Hamid Karzai. There are warlords with known histories of criminal violent behavior condemned across the world that are in parliament. Members of parliament who are women have been kicked out of parliament by men like this. I mean, this is supposedly the freedom that Afghan women got. And under our own occupation, the Taliban that many people in Afghanistan really, you know, reviled are now becoming more popular because they're able to say that we're fighting the U.S. imperialism. And so in a strange way, the U.S. war has actually empowered misogynists on both sides of this war. The Taliban are becoming more legitimate among Afghan people, even though the majority of Afghan people don't agree with their anti-women policies, but because they're the only ones who are claiming that they're protecting people from the bombs of NATO and the U.S. The Time magazine cover should have said something to the effect of, well, this is what is happening to women under our occupation. And another thing that Rick Stengel didn't admit was that Afghan women did enjoy freedoms to an extent before the Soviet invasion in the late 1980s. And, you know, we forget that this history happened. It's not like we sort of freed Afghan women from some barbarism and gave them a taste of freedom that they never knew. They had freedom and they had some level and measure of freedom, but that was all set back because of war and foreign interference.
You see that actually in the Time magazine piece, that there's a paragraph that mentions that 40 years ago, Afghanistan was a fairly cosmopolitan country, particularly in Kabul. So you get this sense that the piece is somewhat at odds with the cover. It begins to fall apart further when you think that this woman who's portrayed on the cover, this happened to her last year. So the presence of U.S. troops in her country did not help her one bit. You do see this debate sort of breaking down along two lines, and it's a very difficult debate to engage, but it's the one that's in the media. You have to support the U.S. war in order to impede the growth or the spread of the Taliban, or you end this war and you unleash this wave of barbarism across the country. You're given those two options in the media, and it seems like it's very difficult to choose the latter.
Well, I think what a lot of people are missing is that the issue of women's rights is essentially a red herring in Afghanistan. No one really cares about women's rights. They only care about women's rights when it becomes important to justify the war, for example, in 2001, and now when the support for the war is flagging. Inside Afghanistan, the issue of women's rights, whether it's legal rights, whether it's political rights, human rights for women, et cetera, it sort of changes with time depending upon who's in power in which locality. But who's fighting wars on which foreign armies are fighting wars and which misogynist or fundamentalist warlords are fighting wars on the ground makes little difference for women. And so I think it should be made very, very clear to most people, women's rights have always been a PR effort for the U.S. military. They've always been part of the PR effort. Wars are not fought to liberate women. Wars are fought over power, but never to liberate women. And, you know, what really, really sickens me is groups like Feminist Majority. On Ms. Magazine, there was a blog post recently about this Time Magazine article where you see the sort of liberal feminist line that continues to buy the justification that the war is somehow going to protect Afghan women. You get the sense that they kind of want it to be. They want the war to be fought for women's rights, and they just think that it's not being done properly, but that if we try hard enough, if we have enough troops on the ground, somehow women's rights will be better protected. And they're completely missing the point and really doing no justice to the term feminist.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, I see this in Time magazine, and my mind is drawn to a couple of months ago where a very brave and well-known Afghan activist is named one of the 100 most influential people in Time magazine, erases her opposition to the war, or at least tries to argue that that opposition to the war is something she needs to get over.
Oh, my goodness. You're talking about Malalai Joya, and it was amazing that she was recognized by Time magazine. But you're right that the little write-up of her in that announcement by Time magazine was essentially to say that she needs to listen a little bit more to the people who are ardently trying to help her, and that, you know, she doesn't know better than, you know, those of us here in the United States, apparently, who are trying to liberate her and her fellow Afghans. It was such a slap in her face. And I really encourage all of your listeners to check out her book that came out, A Woman Among Warlords. If you want to find out what Afghan women and what a true Afghan hero, a woman like Malalai Joya, who is respected and loved throughout the country, what she really thinks about the U.S. occupation, read her book. On page one of her book, she criticizes the U.S. occupation, and she has long called for the occupation to end. And what she and other women's rights activists in Afghanistan are saying, right now we have three enemies on the ground. We have the U.S. and NATO occupation, we have the government warlords in the parliament, and we have the Taliban. It's better for us to fight against two instead of three enemies. And so they want the U.S. and NATO out of there, and they essentially realize that they have to liberate themselves because nobody's going to do it for them.
We've been speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar. She's host of the radio program Uprising, based at KPFK in Los Angeles. She's also the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, and she co-authored the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington, Warlords, and the Propaganda of Silence. Sonali, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
The Bush administration, having declared an open-ended war that could take it anywhere on the planet, now says the planet is not enough. The front page of the May 18th New York Times brought the news that the White House may approve a new national security directive to put weapons in space. The administration seemed eager to downplay the implications. Spokesperson Scott McClellan was quoted by Agence France-Presse saying, "The plan isn't about weaponization at all, really, just about updating space policy." Other sources are less mealy-mouthed. The Times quotes the former acting secretary of the Air Force as saying that strafing and bombing from space are indeed real possibilities. Our next guest has been writing and talking about the militarization of space for several years now. His article, The Phantom Menace, Space Weapons Aren't on Media Radar, ran in Fares magazine Extra in the spring of 1999. Carl Grossman is a journalism professor at the State University of New York, College at Old Westbury, and the author of several books, including The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. He's also vice president and program director at Enviro Video, producer of documentaries, including, most relevantly, Star Wars Returns. Welcome back to Counterspin, Carl Grossman.
A pleasure, Janine.
Well, give us, first of all, if you will, just your initial reaction to this New York Times front page story. I know your reaction can't have been surprise, exactly.
Well, as someone emailed me this morning, does it go in your We Told You So file? Now, that would be kind of being cynical about it. Actually, I was thrilled because the way it works in our wacky nation, if it's on the front page of the New York Times, particularly as a lead story, it becomes a reality. I've been writing about this issue, the weaponization of space, and digging up and presenting documents about the U.S. military and U.S. administrations seeking to control space and from space dominate the planet below for, as you say, years. In fact, it's been almost 20 years.
So there'll be perhaps some debate. I thought it was interesting. The Times quoted an Air Force spokeswoman who said that the focus is not putting weapons in space, but having free access to space. But then just one paragraph later, we heard from Pete Teets, the former acting secretary of the Air Force, who said the thing about how strafing and bombing are real possibilities. How much, if any, legitimacy should we give to this fig leaf, which apparently the White House is going to put out there, that this really isn't about weapons in space at all?
Oh, it's just nonsense. That's less than a fig leaf. Now, Tim Weiner did a wonderful job with this piece. This is not your, he said, she said, it's investigative in nature, and Tim has experience in that field. For example, to discuss, well, what it's called formally is hypervelocity rod bundles, but it's being nicknamed rods from God. These are things made of tungsten or uranium, which would be propelled downward from space. And as he writes, the impact would be comparable to the force of a small nuclear weapon. This is what's happening, and it's so good that, again, it's in the Times. That particular craziness, the rods from God, first time I noticed it was a professional journal published in March of the electrical engineers. It's called IEEE Spectrum, cited this this scheme. But he gives credit to that journal in focusing on the cost and the problems of this issue. So it's a good piece.
Well, in that New York Times piece, there was one thing that leapt out at me very early on. It says that no treaty or law bans Washington from putting weapons in space, barring weapons of mass destruction. Now, is that really the case, that these ideas, these rods from God and other things that we're hearing about, are not in violation of anything?
Well, it seems to me that these rods from God, what an expression, are weapons of mass destruction. I mean, if they're going to hit with the force of small nuclear weapons, what does that be, a big nuclear weapon to be a weapon of mass destruction? Now, clearly, you've gone then to what the Outer Space Treaty forbids with that weapons system. As to some of the other weapon systems, here the U.S. thinks it's going to sort of circumvent the Outer Space Treaty, certainly not the intent of the Outer Space Treaty, but the letter of the Outer Space Treaty, which most nations of the world, incidentally, have ratified. In the United States, the United Kingdom, and the Soviet Union were the three principals in getting it enacted in 1967. I should also note, however, that Canada, China, Russia, with many, many nations behind them, have been trying to expand the Outer Space Treaty to prohibit all weapons in space.
Well, another sentence leapt out at me from the Times report we're talking about, and that was that it said, with little public debate, the Pentagon has already spent billions of dollars developing space weapons and preparing plans to deploy them. That construction almost makes it sound as though the public is at fault, though I don't think that's what he means. And people can hardly debate something that they know nothing about. In general, where have journalists been on this story?
Absolutely out to lunch. Totally dysfunctional. I've received these Project Censored awards time and again now over the years for reporting on the nuclearization and the weaponization of space. And I've said in some of the ceremonies, the very nice ceremonies where you receive the award, I would much rather see what I revealed on 60 Minutes or in the New York Times. Here, happily, it's in the New York Times. But in general, the media have been, as I wrote in that piece in Extra, nowhere on this very, very crucial, very important issue, because the central fallacy of U.S. policy, and in a way the Times gets into this, is that once we move into space with weaponry, you have to expect that China will follow, Russia will follow, other nations will follow, we'll lose any advantage we'd have. The money that would be spent would be enormous. And for those listening who might be a big space enthusiast, imagine if there's a shooting war in space with these lasers and high-velocity guns and particle beams. There'll end up to be so much debris up there, so much litter, that there'd be no way up and out for millennia for people who feel that it's humanity's destiny to explore space.
Now, Carl, taking us back to the beginning and your history and working on this, do you expect your phone to be ringing off the hook? Now the thing that you've been talking about seems like it's actually unrolling in front of our eyes. Do you expect calls from journalists?
Just a very few because, well, again, here you're talking about space, which is sort of of a kind of motherhood, patriotic issue for much of the U.S. media. Walter Cronkite, he was the original cheerleader of U.S. space activities. Then you have nuclear. One of the things that is unfortunately not in the Times piece is how are they going to energize? How are they going to power these weapons up above? And my reporting has shown that the energy source of choice appears to be orbiting nuclear power, atomic power up there. So you have the taboo about reporting on nuclear power and the rah-rah space stuff. So this is not a thing, unhappily, media have jumped into and properly done a good reporting job.
We've been speaking with journalist and professor Carl Grossman. For information on Enviro video documentaries, including the very relevant Star Wars Returns, you can check out their website. It's envirovideo.com. Thank you very much for joining us today, Carl Grossman.
A pleasure.
Our first guest is a veteran foreign correspondent and author of several books. And in 2008, T.R. Reid made Sick Around the World, a documentary for PBS's Frontline that examined how other countries provide health care for their citizens. Frontline followed up Sick Around the World with Sick Around America, which aired recently. But if you saw it, you didn't see Reid, although he did reporting for the film. Why not? Reid says the final film just didn't reflect the reporting that went into it or his earlier work. Frontline says Reid is too much of an advocate, while they wanted the film, which included no supporters of single payer, to be neutral. Well, journalistic disputes are not uncommon, of course, but what does this one tell us about the state of media debate on health care in this country? Are certain political assumptions so ingrained that not even actual reporting can dislodge them? Joining us now by phone from Denver is T.R. Reid. Welcome to Counterspin.
Hi, Janine. Delighted to be here.
Well, without asking you to relive the experience, what was the core difference between the healthcare reality you researched and reported and the one that appeared in the final version of Sick Around America, such that you had to take your name off it?
Well, I don't think the problem is that I was biased. I mean, I've made two other healthcare films for Frontline, and they hired me for the third one, so I don't think they would have considered me biased. You know, people disagree on healthcare policy. It's a topic that some people are ferociously excited about. We have the richest, most powerful country in the world, but we definitely don't have the best healthcare system, and we should, with the money we spend and the training we have for docs and nurses. So people are looking for ways to fix this, and it's, you know, it gets partisan, it gets controversial. What happened on this film is after we finished the reporting, Frontline, the producers and bosses up in Boston put together, edited a film and wrote a script. I didn't see any of this. And by the time I thought it was wrong. And, you know, we talked about it. They listened to me. They didn't want to make any changes. So I said, well, you can't put me in the film. And they said, fine.
Now, did you find factual inaccuracies or was it a question?
No, I didn't find factual inaccuracies. In the part of the film that I was in, I don't think it's anything factually inaccurate. It wasn't that. It's that they kind of steered the logic of their film in a certain way, and they felt that they didn't want to mention any. They did a very good job of explaining problems with American healthcare. They said they didn't want to mention any solutions, but then at the end of their film, they talk about the idea of mandating everybody to buy insurance from the private insurance industry. And the interesting thing is they don't see that as suggesting a solution. To me, that was suggesting a solution, and I don't think it's a solution that represents what we found when we went around the world. So that's what I told them. But I think one of the reasons they don't understand all the criticism of the film is because they genuinely think they were just reporting news and not proposing a solution. I noticed the fair write-up of the film criticized them for picking this one solution, but the people at Frontline would still say, oh, no, no, we didn't pick any solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Fair did do an action alert on Sick Around America because we found that they treated, in our view, mandatory for-profit insurance coverage as really the only alternative to the current U.S. system. But
Also, we noted that the film asserts really at one point that the way that other developed countries guarantee universal coverage is, as the narrator put it, quote, they make insurers cover everyone and they make all citizens buy insurance and the poor are subsidized, close quote. But is that really the lesson you took away from those countries that allow some private sector role in health financing, that they people are required to buy insurance from for-profit companies?
No, that's a really good point. Many countries do provide health care for everybody with private doctors, private insurance, and private hospitals. It's not all socialized medicine. As you remember, that was the point of our first film. That's the point of my forthcoming book. But none of those countries allow the insurance companies to make a profit on basic coverage. All those countries require that insurance companies pay every claim. They can't deny claims like ours do. And they all have controls on the administrative costs on the insurance companies. Most insurance companies around the world have administrative costs about one-fourth or one-fifth as high as the paperwork costs at American companies. So that's kind of what I felt, to suggest that no country would mandate anybody into an American health insurance company, because it's just not the kind of insurance any other country has.
Well, Frontline's comment, and we touched on it, they asserted that the dispute centered on a conflict between Frontline's journalistic commitment to fair and nuanced reporting and its aversion to policy advocacy, and Mr. Reed's commitment to advocacy for specific health care policy reforms. In other words, you have an agenda and they don't. But setting aside health care per se, I wonder what your response to that is as a journalist. You know, that you are too involved in the issue and that you're wedded to particular solutions and therefore you can't report it.
Yeah, it's really an interesting question. In the first place, I'm not wedded to particular solutions. If you look at the last chapter of my forthcoming book, I argue that we can borrow ideas from lots of different countries. There's no particular plan or approach that has to work. That we have to adopt. I don't think I'm wedded to a particular solution. I am wedded to the notion that everybody in America should have access to the doctor when they need it, and that this should be done fairly and at a reasonable cost. And is that bias? Some people would criticize that and say, no, healthcare is a commodity, and if you can afford it, you can get it. I don't agree with that view, so does that make me biased? I'll tell you, Janine, I've covered a lot of presidential campaigns for the Washington Post. And, you know, you get on the airplane with the candidate and you travel around the country with her for weeks or months. And, you know, it's pretty hard not to decide yourself either this person would be a great president or this person would be a total baboon in the White House. You know what I mean? So, of course, reporters develop preferences or ideas or partisan feelings. That happens. I think the craft is to get around them. The craft, at least in American journalism, is to try to present the issue fairly and let the reader decide.
That was T.R. Reed talking with Counterspin in April 2009. Before that, you heard Carl Grossman from 2005 and Sonali Kolhatkar from 2010. All of it evidence that while the headlines may change, the need to look behind them does not. That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. We're online at fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for the harsh reality of our future in a hotter world? Can any of us really handle the truth? If you feel strong enough, this may be the most devastating look into where we really stand. Perhaps you remember UK writer Mark Linus stunning us with the awful changes on Earth if we warm by 5 degrees centigrade, and we may not survive 6. Many hope the climate talks in Paris can reach an agreement that will save a livable climate for all our descendants and keep global warming below 2 degrees C. But what if the national leaders are just players on a stage of illusion? What if someone told you our current levels of greenhouse gases already commit us to more than 6 degrees of global warming and over 12 meters, over 36 feet higher sea levels? And that may not be the worst of it. I'm Alex Smith with a remarkable interview from London. This is Radio EcoShock, radio you need to hear. Humans have a known tendency to either panic and hide or fight against the wrong enemy. So I try to stick to rational voices and back those up with the best scientific proof we can find. Our guest David Wasdell is one of those voices, but now he's poking big holes in mainstream hopes and illusions about saving ourselves from climate change. His latest video and paper is called Climate Dynamics: Facing the Harsh Realities of Now. David Wasdell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Hey, it's always good to work with you on the critical issues that you raise. And to know that our discussion is being heard by a global audience that is both well-informed and passionately concerned. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Well, indeed they are. We've got a fantastic group of listeners, and they are well-informed. So I thought, just to let the listeners know what they're in for, why don't we start with a quick round of kind of yes or no questions?
Alex, that sounds like a great way to set the agenda, but, you know, I can't guarantee one-word answers. Well, let's have a go.
Okay. Number one, world leaders meet in Paris to reach an agreement to keep the world safe from dangerous climate change, even if they agree to all the voluntary goals set by each country. Will that be enough to keep climate change below 2 degrees centigrade of warming?
Absolutely not.
Right. Question two, do we have a comfortable margin of carbon we can burn and still avoid catastrophic climate change?
No. We've overshot that boundary by a massive amount.
Question three, have leading scientists modified science for politicians because the harsh realities of what we need to do are unrealistic?
Unrealistic or unacceptable. Sadly, what you're talking about is correct.
Number four, is it true that the United Nations projections of climate change, including those from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, routinely leave out important warming forces?
That is true.
Is it conceivable, David, even possible, we are setting planet Earth on a path towards heating of 8 degrees or more centigrade, or say 16 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, in the next 100 or 200 years?
Alex, that is exactly where we are headed.
And finally, if we don't wake up and act, can this generation ruin the Earth for humanity and other species for thousands of years? Well, there you have it, listeners. All this is part of a stunning new video lecture and paper called Climate Dynamics: Facing the Harsh Realities of Now. The presentation is by our guest, David Wasdell. He's the director of the Apollo Gaia Project. I've followed David's work for years. In December 2010, we did an interview for a Radio EcoShock show called Beyond the Tipping Point. Wasdell is well-versed in science. He keeps in touch with other scientists around the world. As an independent analyst with no institutional ties, David is free to bring out the climate science few others discuss openly with the public. Well, I've interviewed several psychologists about the human ability to lie to ourselves, but your talk goes much deeper because you're looking at vast institutional fantasies where even science is tempered by a kind of real politic. What did the famous German climate scientist John Schellenhuber tell you about that several years ago?
Hey, you know, the idea of an available carbon budget, as we call it, was introduced just prior to the 2009 Copenhagen conference by a big think tank in Germany, the WGBU, if you translate it, the German Advisory Council on Global Change. The introduction to that report was written by Professor John Schellenhuber, who was the chair of the WBGU Council at that time. By the way, John was one of my initial colleagues at the start of the Apollo Gaia project. But in that introduction, he wrote, "This report is a compromise between what is scientifically necessary and what is politically and economically feasible." Do that again. This report is a compromise between what is scientifically necessary, what the situation demands, if you like, and what can be tolerated politically and economically. See, when key scientists put out reports that have already made that compromise, so that what they report to policymakers is already an appeasement document in terms of what the political and economic vested interests will tolerate, that, in my opinion, they've already lost their authority as scientists.
But we do need to keep this carbon fantasy going. Otherwise, David, how will we drive to work or feed ourselves? Why do you think that now is a critical time to face the harsh realities about climate change?
Spot on. But you know, Alex, our patterns of work, our city design, our building architecture, our transport arrangements, food production, population growth, power generation, military strategy, political, economic, and financial institutions have all developed in the context of a virtually unlimited supply of cheap fossil energy. That age is over. Not because we've run out of fossil fuel, it's far from it, but because the collateral damage from burning the vast amounts involved has changed the very composition of the air we breathe and dramatically transformed the energy balance of our planetary home. Digging ourselves out of that hole requires a transformation the likes of which we have never before been faced by our human civilization. And it's urgent.
So let's dive into your work. I found your comparison between changes in Earth temperature and our own body temperature make it easier to understand. How do they compare?
Well, Alex, you know, the planet acts a little bit like your own body. I mean, in response to temperature. You think, if your temperature goes up by, what, 3 or 4 degrees, you're going into life-threatening stress. 5 degrees, you're probably dead. At 3.5, I don't know, possibly going into delirium. On the other hand, if your temperature drops by about 2 or 3 degrees, you're suffering hypothermia. So you and all of us in this program have a very narrow temperature scale within which to operate. Our bodies are very sensitive to small changes in temperature, and so is the planet. Let's put it this way. Just 5 degrees centigrade marks the difference between 1.5 miles of ice over Ottawa and the bustling capital city we know and love today. 5 degrees, that's all. So in that sense, global sensitivity to temperature change is extremely high. Now, from a different perspective, if you catch flu, your temperature goes up. But if you've got streptococcal meningitis, it goes up a lot further and faster. So there's a sensitivity of temperature to pathogen behavior. And there is also a sensitivity of the body to change in temperature. Two very different sorts of sensitivity. So at a planetary level, we can distinguish between the sensitivity of global climate to changes in temperature and sensitivity of global temperature to changes in carbon dioxide. Make sense?
It does. It really helps, I think, to picture this. A number of scientists, including Dr. James Hansen, have warned that the 2 degrees centigrade limit on warming is not safe at all. In fact, Hansen recently said it was crazy to think so. Do you agree?
Well, Alex, my short answer is yes. My long answer goes on a bit further. Tiny changes in planetary temperature have big effects on global climate. You can see that already with the present increase of just under 1 degree centigrade. Droughts, fires, crop failure across California and other southern states, not to mention Australia, desertification and collapse of subsistence agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa with starvation, disease, migration, and conflict. Loss of 70% of the floating sea ice in the Arctic. The start of methane release from seabed permafrost. Disruption of the circumpolar jet stream with the weirding of weather across the northern hemisphere. And the northern part of the United States and Canada have seen all about that, with the heating on the western seaboard, intense cold on the eastern seaboard. Knock-on effects of that in the monsoon behavior across Asia with crop failure, multiple farmer suicides in northern India, devastating flooding in some areas, increase in the strength of rainfall and in the power of tropical storms with changes to their normal routes, loss of 40% of phytoplankton around the globe, damage to coral reefs and the ocean food chain. In your neck of the woods, spread of bark beetle with dieback and burn in the Canadian pine forests. The shift from carbon sink to carbon source in the Amazon rainforest with dieback wildfires and the start of the change from forest to savanna. Species extinction running at, what, about 1,000 times normal background rate? Oh, and loss of about 500 cubic kilometers per year and rising from land-based ice. 20 centimeters of sea level rise, which is about a tenth of what's already in the pipeline. Extreme water shortage in the countries around the Mediterranean with social unrest, escalating conflict, accelerating migration, and economic collapse. Alex, we are way beyond safe climate change already, at just under 1 degree. So a rise of 2 degrees centigrade would lead to over 4.5 meters, about 15 feet rise in sea level, and a multiplication of all the effects we've just been noticing today. The 2 degrees ceiling might give temporary protection to the profits from fossil energy, but it would be a catastrophic commitment for humanity as a whole. So yes, I agree with James Hansen. Setting a rise of 2 degrees centigrade as a global target and calling it safe is sheer madness.
David Wasdell, you explained developing new science on climate sensitivity. How would you define climate sensitivity to the person on the street?
Alex, thank you for asking that. It brings us right back to today and right back to the ground. You know, the very air we breathe is, what, about 4/5 nitrogen and 1/5 oxygen? That makes up pretty well 100%, doesn't it? Those gases allow light and heat radiation through in both directions without any interference. Carbon dioxide itself is a trace gas. The atmosphere contains, what, 0.02% of carbon dioxide by volume. Tiny, tiny amounts, relatively speaking. But CO2 is a greenhouse gas. It allows light in from the sun, but it blocks some of the heat energy from being radiated back out again. And along with water vapor, ozone, and methane, it acts like a thermostat. It controls the surface temperature of the planet within a range of about 35 degrees centigrade. Now, burning fossil hydrocarbons for energy, which is what we've been doing since the Brits started to dig up coal back in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, burning fossil hydrocarbons for energy increases the concentration of atmospheric CO2. If you like, it changes the setting on the thermostat, and it pushes up the surface temperature of the planet. Now, obviously, we need to calibrate the thermostat. The measure we've chosen is a doubling of the concentration of atmospheric CO2. All right? So the question is, how much does the surface temperature of the Earth go up if we double the concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide? The answer to that question is what we mean by climate sensitivity. So if the value is pretty low, that's okay. We can emit large quantities of carbon dioxide without pushing the temperature up too far. But if the value is much higher, then emitting even quite small amounts of carbon dioxide has a big effect on temperature. So getting that figure right is absolutely crucial for setting future strategy.
Well, that leads to my next question. How did the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, manage to set climate sensitivity far too low?
Alex, there are two ways to tackle the problem. We can build computer models of the system and read off the resulting predictions. Alternatively, we can look in detail at the relationship between carbon dioxide concentration and associated surface temperature over millions of years of our planetary history. But here I think I need to take a step back and understand a bit more about that thermostat. The effect of change in CO2 concentration on its own is actually known pretty accurately. Trouble is, it sets off a whole host of other mechanisms, what we call feedback effect, that amplify what the change in CO2 does on its own. Now, some of those feedbacks are well known and can be quantified and confidently used in the computer models. Others are known but cannot easily be quantified, if you like, the known unknowns. Then there's a whole set of unknown feedbacks and relationships between them all that are beyond current understanding. The unknown unknowns, if you like. Now, the set of computer models used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, only work with the feedback mechanisms that can be quantified. It's obvious. Inevitably, that only gives part of the picture. But in contrast, the history of the planet and its change includes, by definition, all the feedback processes, known and unknown, positive and negative, that is, amplifying or damping the process, together with all the complex interactions between them. So, computer models predict that the temperature change from doubling the concentration of CO2 would be about 3 degrees centigrade. But using the history of the actual relationship between temperature and CO2 concentration in planetary history, we find the outcome is more like 8 degrees centigrade. That's a huge difference, and it has massive strategic implications. So, you see, the reality of Earth system sensitivity is about, what, 2.5 times that comes from the partial computer models? And, oh, and by the way, then we get into politics and economics that really drive the selection of the facts. The main IPCC report clearly stated that the relationship between predicted temperature and total emissions depends on the value of climate sensitivity. That's correct. But that fact is ignored in the summary for policymakers. And, of course, in the synthesis report that is being used as the basis for the Paris conference starting next month. The low computer-generated value was selected as the basis for strategy against strong academic advice. But, you know, that decision clearly fits the economic agenda of the fossil industry, and I suppose that's what largely controls the political position. You could say it's an example of policy-selected climate science, rather than what we really need, which is science-directed climate policy.
I suppose this means that a smaller amount of carbon dioxide and a lesser rise in global mean temperature will do much more damage than we thought. Is that it?
You're spot on, mate.
Listeners, you're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. David Wasdell. We're talking about the harsh realities of now, a new presentation that he's brought out about the realities of climate change. A key part of your presentation, well shown in simple graphs, are the layers of feedbacks that amplify the measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. David, could you take some time now to tell us about that? Let's start with the so-called fast feedbacks or Charney feedbacks.
Wow. Alex, it sounds like you're asking for a sort of mini tutorial at this point. Is that okay?
That's exactly what we need, yes.
Okay, well, let's have a go. Hang in here. In order to maintain the energy balance of the Earth, the average surface temperature of the planet has to change by 1 degree centigrade to compensate for about 3.8 watts per square meter of radiant energy that is blocked by change in the greenhouse effect. Got it? Now, if the temperature changed by 5 degrees between the depth of the last ice age and the pre-industrial benchmark, 5 degrees, then it means that 5 times 3.8 watts, 19 watts per square meter, has been blocked because of change in the greenhouse effect and the change in the reflectivity of the planet from changes in the ice fields and so on during that period. 19 watts per square meter. Let's keep that in mind. So what are the elements that gave rise to that change? I'm going to introduce them in sort of layers. I'm going to start with change in solar energy. Then I'm going to add the contribution of carbon dioxide on its own. Then I'll look at the effects of the fast feedbacks, the Charney sensitivity. Explore that later. That's going to be followed by the carbon cycle feedbacks, which we call the Hadley sensitivity, the ice sheet dynamics, named after Jim Hansen, and finally, the full Earth system sensitivity, which includes all the amplifying processes. Okay, let's start. To start with, then, there's a change of about half a watt per square meter in solar energy received during this time because of the change in the shape of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. It's not a lot. That leaves us about 18.5 watts. Keep going. Change in the concentration of carbon dioxide contributed, 2.3 watts per square meter during that period? But the Earth system amplifies the effect of carbon dioxide. So if you just look at the contribution from CO2 on its own, we still have to account for about 84% of the change in the planetary behavior. Okay, let's go on. Next, we're putting in the effects of the fast feedback response. We call it the Charney sensitivity, so-called because a guy called Jules Charney was the chair of the original committee that worked on this back in, 1979, I think. These fast feedbacks are, firstly, atmospheric water vapor. It's a powerful greenhouse gas, and it increases almost instantaneously with rising temperature. Then cloud behavior changes and increases the feedback. Clouds reflect sunlight back into space. They also reflect infrared energy, the heat energy, back down towards the surface of the Earth. So their behavior goes in two ways. One is a negative feedback, one is a positive feedback. But the amplifying feedback wins. So it's a net amplifier. Thirdly, the area of floating sea ice decreases with rising temperature, and that reduces the reflection of solar energy, so we absorb more energy with rising temperature. These three feedbacks come into action as soon as temperature starts to change. That's why they're called fast feedback. Though, mind you, the resulting heating is very slow. They add about, 5 watts per square meter during this period. That still leaves 60%, 58% roughly, still unaccounted for. Oh, by the way, did you know the current set of climate models, the one used as the basis for the fifth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, deals only with these fast feedbacks? It's amazing to many people. But workgroups 2 and 3 of that report, together with all the subsequent analysis and reports prepared in the run-up to Paris Climate Conference, all share this same methodological dependency. They all use an understanding of climate feedback dynamics that falls short of reality by about 60%. But they persist in using that inappropriate figure as the basis of the international negotiations in Paris. Let's move on. Some of the more sophisticated supercomputer models, like the UK Hadley Centre, which is why we use the word Hadley feedback, Hadley sensitivity, also include some of the effects of the carbon cycle feedbacks, which add about another 3 1/3 watts to the per square metre. But, you know, we're still 41% short of the 19 watts per square metre we need to balance the energy budget. Oh, by the way, the carbon cycle feedbacks are not taken into account in the IPCC advice to policymakers. They're noted, of course, in the main body of the report, but left out in the political advice. And that situation reflects a long-standing policy in the work of the IPCC. It tends to focus on the output from the most basic computer models, while the more sophisticated ones are seen as, like, outliers, and they tend to be ignored. Mind you, using non-modeled historical data, James Hansen, until recently director at NASA's GISS institution, has included long-term ice dynamics. That's the changing reflection from the big land-based ice sheets. Obviously, as the ice sheets melt, they don't reflect the sunlight back, so the Earth heats faster, and that feedback adds another 3.6 watts per square meter. Hey, but you know, even Hansen's work is still about 22% short of the target. So we've got a gap. The dynamics of the planet as a whole, with all its feedbacks, known and unknown, and all their interaction, adds a final 4.1 watts per square meter to the total. And that completes the change of 19 watts per square meter between the depth of the Ice Age and the pre-industrial benchmark. That's the figure we need to be working with in making strategic policies. And it's the ground of what we've come to term the full Earth system sensitivity.
That was a lot, and I'm hoping listeners will download this as a podcast as well and re-listen to that, because I think that's the way to go. And you can get it from my blog at ecoshock.info, the Wednesday of the week that this is broadcast.
And by the way, Alex, you can also get it on the Apollo Gaia website, both as a PDF printout and also as a full video. Did you know that?
Yes. So, all right. So where do listeners go to get that?
Well, we'll probably give that at the end, but it goes on apollo-gaia.org and then goes straight to the first big title on the homepage, which is called Climate Dynamics, Facing the Harsh Realities of Now.
Okay, and I recommend that listeners do that. But first, I'd like to backtrack a little bit into something you just talked about. Please explain a little bit about the carbon cycle feedbacks.
Carbon cycle. Well, as the concentration of carbon dioxide goes up in the atmosphere, many trees and plants go, oh, yippee, this is sort of atmospheric food. And they start to grow a bit faster and absorb more of the CO2. So as the concentration of CO2 goes up and the temperature goes up, we begin to see more CO2 absorbed. But then they get a bit sick of that and they say, this is too rich. And as the CO2 goes up more, the little stomata on the back of the leaves start to shrink and not so many of them open, and the trees and the plants take in less CO2. So instead of being a growing sink of carbon in the atmosphere, they become a net source of carbon in the atmosphere. And that's pretty critical. There are many, many other carbon feedbacks. For instance, plankton. Plankton absorb a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and turn it into various chemicals in their metabolism. But as the carbon concentration goes up, the phytoplankton don't like the acidity of the resulting ocean surface concentrations, and that damages the plankton. And we've already lost quite a lot of that from around the planet. That means they don't absorb so much carbon from the atmosphere. That increases, therefore, the amount of carbon that stays in the atmosphere. There are a host of little carbon feedbacks, some of them big, some of them small, some of them fast, some of them slow. And Hadley has had a good shot at dealing with some of those. It's probably the best model in the world that does that.
So you say the whole collection of feedbacks amplify the simple effect of adding carbon to the atmosphere by a factor of 8. What does that really mean?
Well, as we've seen, the effect of changing the concentration of CO2 on its own is quite small. But change in temperature it initiates actually sets off a great range of feedback mechanisms, which increase its power by a factor of about 8. It's a bit like feeding a small signal from a microphone into the amplifier of a PA system. That increases the power of the signal and feeds it out into a large auditorium. Does that help?
Yes, I think that's so important to understand, and I didn't really grasp that before going through your paper. So please tell us what doubling CO2 from 280 parts per million, which it was in pre-industrial times, to 560 parts per million, which could happen in the near future, what does that produce as we include each stage of those feedbacks?
Well, I'll do my best. Moving from the specific example of change since the last ice age, we can derive the value of the more generalized climate sensitivity. That's the equilibrium change in average surface temperature of the planet following a doubling of the concentration of atmospheric CO2. Now then, the temperature change required to compensate for the effect of doubling CO2 concentration on its own is about 0.97 of a degree, almost 1 degree centigrade. Okay. Climate sensitivity, when only the fast feedbacks are taken into consideration, puts that up to 3 degrees. When you include the effects of the carbon cycle feedbacks, the sensitivity value goes up to 4.5 degrees as a result of just doubling the CO2. You add in the contribution from the ice sheet dynamics, and that goes up to 6 degrees for the value of climate sensitivity. While the sensitivity value representing the equilibrium dynamics of the Earth as a whole stands at 7.8 degrees following a doubling of CO2. Though I've got a caveat here, which I think is a bit scary. Please note, this figure is derived from slow and close to equilibrium conditions of change in the whole series of glacial interglacial periods stretching back over 1 million years. and it may be too low in the current conditions of the Anthropocene. So the figure I'm using in this paper is probably a bit conservative rather than way out and scary. Well, it's still scary, but it's not way out. You know, if you're working with computer models using only fast feedbacks, you'd predict that 2 degrees centigrade would be achieved at around 440 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. However, if you use, as you really must, the full Earth system sensitivity, then at 440 parts per million, you're going to be looking at about 5 degrees centigrade of change, not 2. You see, I keep reminding you, the computer simulation, inadequate and partial though it may be, is what is still being fed into the process of strategic policy making, on this assumption that the temperature change is only 2 degrees for a concentration of 440 parts per million of CO2. It's an illusion, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is David Wasdell from London, England. All right. This is a bit frightening because I remember when Mark Linus wrote his book, What Would Happen at 5 Degrees and What Would Happen at 6, and it looks like we're already committed to 5 or 6 degrees. We'll get to that. Okay, so what is the eventual warming, or as you say, the implicit temperature we can expect from our current level of 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Right. Well, we're just about hitting the 400 parts per million this year, aren't we? It's an extraordinary level to be going above. I don't think many people thought we'd get there that fast. Well, Alex, I've introduced the concept of implicit temperature change as a way of addressing the question, what is the eventual change in temperature to be expected as a result of any specific level of rise in the concentration of atmospheric CO2? It kind of collapses the time dimension and says, well, you know, what we've done is this, the response is going to be that. So today, at 400 parts a million, we have an implicit temperature increase of about 4 degrees centigrade in the pipeline as a result of current concentrations of carbon dioxide. That's pretty clear. But we've also emitted nitrous oxide and ozone and methane and chlorofluorocarbons and hydrofluorocarbons and about 15 other very trace but powerful greenhouse gases from our global use of chemistry. And if you add the effects of all those non-CO2 greenhouse gases together, then there's about 480 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent, as we call it, already in the atmosphere. It's adding about 54% to the effects of the carbon dioxide and its feedbacks on their own. So the implicit temperature increase from the full amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today is about 6.2 degrees centigrade. When it's all worked through to equilibrium. It could take a long time, but that's the implicit change in temperature for which we are now responsible.
But that is fantastic. Are you really saying we're not just doomed to go past the supposed 2-degree safety barrier, which isn't safe, but we are already committed to over 6 degrees centigrade of warming eventually, just with our current greenhouse gases in the atmosphere?
Absolutely correct, Alex, except, and I do need to say that, we're only doomed, as you put it, and I'm not a doom monger, we're only doomed if we decide to do nothing about it. Let's keep that right on the top of our agenda.
Well, leading from that, I think you will agree there's a huge gap, a kind of failure of the human mind that stops us from facing realities like this and taking action to save ourselves. You've called it dynamic inertia, and that acts like a trap in our experience. It fools people into thinking things aren't so bad, the climate disruption must be a long way off. How does inertia work in the world's climate system?
You know, human beings, and that's us, have evolved to react to immediate threat. You know, you see a saber-toothed tiger coming out from the jungle, and you go, yow, run, at least faster than the person behind you. I remember being asked what would have to happen to motivate adequate response at a seminar I was at in Seattle. My answer was, if that kind of event occurred, it would already be far too late to take effective action. You see, the inertia of the Earth system is massive, Alex. The observed effects lag far behind the already applied causes. The huge time lag. And I think that behavior is ever so apparent when we note implicit temperature change caused by current cumulative emissions stands at 6.2 degrees centigrade, but observed temperature change is only registered, what, about 0.85 of a degree centigrade? Could go up to 1 degree this year with the big El Nino in the Pacific. So explicit observed change stands, what, at about 13, 14% of the implicit eventual change. Over 86% of implicit temperature change is still in the pipeline. Wow. And by the way, sea level change is much harder. Sea level change is sort of subject to a double inertia, isn't it? In terms of what temperature, observed effects lag massively behind applied cause. But in terms of sea level change, the observed temperature change itself, that's the observed temperature change itself, acts as cause. And the change in sea level lags massively behind the change in observed temperature change. And the temperature change lags, in turn, massively behind implicit change in temperature. And that is driven by the fundamental cause of systems change, namely our total cumulative human-driven carbon emissions. Let's put this quantitatively. Observed temperature change of 0.85 degrees centigrade implies a sea level rise of 2 meters. That's what's in the pipeline now, of which only 20 centimeters, that's about 10%, has actually occurred so far. Then think, 0.85 of a degree centigrade is only about 14% of currently implicit temperature change. So observed rise in global sea level of just 20 centimeters represents just under 1.5% of the current implicit change in global sea level. Over 98% of implicit rise in sea level is still to come. I want to just go do a bit of an aside here, Alex, may I? Yeah. You know, it's imperative that the implicit changes, what we're really in for, are taken as the basis for current decision-making. I sometimes say, you know, we have to stand at the bar of history and say, we knew the implicit change resulting from what we are doing to the planet is this. Yes, we'd only observed a tiny amount of it, but we knew this lot was coming and was inherent in what we had done. Do we really dare to stand at the bar of history and say, we knew these levels of temperature change, these levels of sea level change, were going to be the outcome of our strategic decision-making? And yet, in the moment, we refuse to take them into account? It's crazy.
All right. Let's move ahead further into the implicit rising seas. We have a huge impact with an even bigger delay built in. I'm talking about rising sea levels, and some of my scientific guests say that rising seas may have even more impact on human civilization than rising temperatures. How do you see rising seas reshaping the geography of the world?
You know, I think that's one of the most important risks we face, to be honest. There's a series of recent studies that provided a pretty reasonable, robust rule of thumb that says about 2.3 meters of eventual change in global sea level will occur for each 1 degree change in average global surface temperature. What's 2.3 meters in about 7 feet, I suppose, is it? You know, if the current implicit change in global surface temperature, which stands at 6.2 degrees, then the current implicit change in sea level stands at 14.25 meters. Of which only 20 centimeters has been observed to date. Wow, we're going to have a rise in sea level. Let's put a barrier around the seaward front of Venice that'll protect Venice from about 1 meter of sea level change. How unrealistic is that? The so-called safe ceiling of a rise of 2 degrees would lead to an increase of 4.6 meters of sea level. Doesn't sound safe to me. And by the way, if cumulative total emissions could not be reduced below the level to which the current set of promises put up for the Paris conference would lead, then the implicit increase in average global surface temperature will be just over 10 degrees centigrade, not 4, as predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel, and that would be reflected in an implicit rise in global sea level of over 23 meters. Alex, that's the best that's on the table for the Paris Climate Conference.
You're talking about the height of tall buildings.
Yeah.
Oh, this isn't good. So, David Wasdell, is there a way to know the pace and the destination of these implicit sea level rise? Do we know how fast, really know how fast it will come?
Well, historically, you know, the pace of ice melt, and therefore the change in sea level, has danced in tune with the multi-thousand-year timescales reflecting astronomical changes in orbital shape and the tilt and wobble of the Earth's axis of rotation. It's been very slow. Today, the pace of ice melt is driven by rapid increase in global temperature, not slow astronomical change. It's about 2,500 times the astronomical pace. So we have absolutely no historical precedent by which to predict the timing and the rate of sea level change. It's likely to be exponential. The faster it goes, the faster it goes, tiddly-pom, and much more rapid than current models suggest. So while, for instance, the IPCC may be looking at about 65 centimeters by the end of the century, some of our scientists are saying it could be 3 or 4 meters by the end of the century. And if the rate of change in temperature really takes off, and it's meant to, by all accounts, then it could be more than that by the end of the century. I don't like it.
Meanwhile, at various conferences, in the business press and in scientific circles, there's been a lot of effort to work out how much more carbon we can still burn in the form of oil, gas, and coal, and still remain below this 2-degree warming limit. We've talked about how silly that is in a way and how dangerous that is. And no doubt diplomats at the Paris conference will still talk about this carbon budget. How much of a budget do we really have left?
Or do we have any at all? That's the $64 trillion question, isn't it? Well, let's start like this. At present, CO2 concentration stands at 400 parts per million. Okay, we know that. If it's thought to be safe to go up to 440 parts per million, then we've got a good budget to play with, haven't we? So there's still plenty of room in what I call the skyfill site. However, if we don't depend on the inadequate computer models and instead, as we really should, apply the full Earth system sensitivity, then we are already committed to passing, or at least we were already committed to passing the 2-degree ceiling when CO2 concentration stood at, wait for it, 334 parts per million. That's over 60 parts per million less than the current concentration. It was back in 1978. So we've already overspent the budget, as they call it, by a huge amount. We're bankrupt. You getting the picture?
David, how did you work out your real carbon budget, and what do you base these calculations on?
Okay. I'll be as brief as I can, Alex. Let me explain available carbon budget like this. If we estimate temperature impact of what we've already emitted is, say, X degrees centigrade, and we need to keep the increase to not more than 2, then if we estimate between X and 2 there's still significant space in the skyfall site, then that is the budget. How much more can we dump in the skyfall site and be safe? But, you know, once that available carbon budget is established, we have one almighty punch-up in the international community. And this is the process of the huge COP conferences. You know, some are saying, look, we've got the right to emit. No, we have the right to emit. This is not equitable or just. We want differentiated responsibilities. Look at the history of who has put out what. Look at our needs. We are developing countries. Oh, we depend for our survival on income from fossil industries. You can't take that away from us. Look at sea level rise. We've lost our livelihood. We've got nowhere to live. So this group of conflicted interests is trying to wrangle over how to spend an assumed budget, which probably doesn't exist. Okay, so how do you calculate available carbon budget? Well, here's a summary. There's a lot in my video and the PDF, but This is about 4 or 5 lines of summary. We know pretty accurately how much carbon has been emitted since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Okay? That gives us a figure for the implicit temperature increase. If we stick to inadequate computer values for climate sensitivity, then the IPCC estimates a remaining carbon budget of, what, about 250 gigatons of carbon before we pass the 2 degrees boundary? Using the full Earth system sensitivity shows we've overshot that boundary by, what, 323 gigatons of carbon? We've probably got to put the ceiling back from 2 degrees to 1 degree, and that increases the overshot, the bankruptcy, to a total of 464 gigatons of carbon. And even that doesn't take into account non-CO2 greenhouse gases that add about 54% to the effects of CO2 emissions. So there's a way there, and it's much more detailedly set out in the resources you have available. Let's go on.
All right. That's at apollo-gaia.org. You can watch the full video and really tune into the science of this. So I do want to ask you this rather harsh question because I think it could become a reality. What has to happen for the world to warm a full 10 degrees centigrade?
We have to give up dealing with the problem is the first answer. National promises, the independent nationally determined contributions, or INDCs as they're called, concerning reductions in CO2 emissions, have all been tabled ahead of COP21 in Paris. Alex, those promises look like pushing us up to about 700 parts per million by the end of the century, if they're implemented. And I guess there's no guarantee about that whatsoever. Business as usual, what we're literally committed to at the moment, is driving us towards more like 800 or 900 parts per million up there. And if we can't improve the levels of promised emissions reduction, then IPCC says, hey, we might hit 4 degrees centigrade using its low value for sensitivity. But if we use the full Earth system sensitivity, which we really should be doing by now, to examine the way the climate behaves at a level of 700 parts per million, we're not looking at around 4 degrees. We're looking at an increase of more like 10 degrees as a result of the best promises on the table in Paris. That's twice the temperature shift between the depth of the last ice age and the pre-industrial benchmark. And if we're not able to cut back on our current business-as-usual behavior, then temperature rise increases to more like 12 or even 15 degrees. And by the way, 2 or 3 times that amount in the Arctic. Alex, that means goodbye all the ice on Earth. Welcome to something like 90 feet of sea level rise when all of the Greenland ice cap and the whole of Antarctica melts at this level. Human civilization would have collapsed ages before we reached that. London and New York would be underwater, and so would a lot more of the world.
Now, you haven't left it at that. You have some advice on strategy and on stabilization. I'd like to get to that. A small group of scientists will advise UK Prime Minister David Cameron and all the world leaders on what to say at the Paris COP21 climate summit in December 2015. If you wrote that report for leaders, what strategy would you recommend?
Wow, some responsibility. Hey, this whole presentation was actually conceived at an event organized by the Global Leaders Academy way back in spring this year. I think the task of leadership in this context is truly awesome. Alex, you referred to world leaders attending the Paris summit, but you know, they attend in their role as national representatives. And however well-intentioned the wording of the final communique, each leader is present at that conference to fight for the best interests of the nation they represent. It's a struggle group. In a sense, they're fighting over limited resources and trying to minimize threats to national interests. True global leadership steps up a level. It has to. It has to recognize the overall planetary scale of the crisis, the resolution of which requires collaboration to triumph over competition. National interest bows to the overarching requirements of global survival, the achievement of which is ultimately in the best interest of each and every one of the nation states involved. I think maybe nation states evolving is also critical here, don't you? Yeah. Freudian slips sometimes tell us a lot. But to return, look, you have a request for a scientific briefing for those leaders. Now, at the moment, every report every paper being prepared and presented ahead of the Paris conference has a threefold mantra. One, 2 degrees ceiling. Two, budget approach to negotiations. Three, strategy of goal achievement by reduction of carbon emissions. And the pressure to collude with that party line is phenomenal. You dare step out of line. Can I say this? Any agreement reached in Paris on those terms would be a strategic disaster. It would commit humanity to a course of action that would guarantee catastrophic climate change, with all the unmanageable consequences that would involve. And, Alex, there is also profound pressure to determine strategic response by reference to currently observed changes in the global climate system. That's grossly inadequate as an approach when we're dealing with any complex system subject to the kind of massive time delays between cause and effect that we've already noted. So strategic response must be ordered by the scale of implicit change in system behavior rather than by reaction to minor systems already presenting themselves for observation. So what are the conclusions? And this is how I'd put them in the report. It's now abundantly clear that limiting temperature change to 2 degrees cannot be achieved by emissions reductions on their own. There is no available carbon budget. It's already massively overspent. We're bankrupt even for the 2-degree centigrade target. Moreover, the 2-degree centigrade target has been set far too high. It's far too dangerous. It must be reduced from 2 through 1.5 to 1 at the very most, and possibly even further, if we're going to avoid dangerous climate change and so conform with the globally agreed terms of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Yes, emissions reduction is a necessary but not sufficient step towards climate stabilization. In addition, it's now imperative to draw down much of the stock of emitted greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere. What does that mean? Well, it means we've got to move beyond reduced emissions and a low-carbon economy, pass through and beyond the zero-carbon economy, and then achieve a substantial carbon drawdown economy at a global level and within the shortest possible time frame. It's a kind of demand that moves us beyond the current one-dimensional strategy of emissions reduction to an integrated two-dimensional strategy that also includes stock reduction. I think that would be the sort of gist of the report. Whether any of the leaders would be able to understand it and take it seriously in the light of the huge pressure on them is another matter altogether.
Well, I wish we had time to go through your five-step program to stabilize the climate. I don't think that we do. I'm going to have to ask listeners to go to your video and to read your PDF document that's available on your website to get those five steps, because as you can tell, listeners, he's made a lot of sense so far, and the five steps I think would do it. But I'd like to close out a little bit with the fact that you do have a dream of an alternative civilization for humanity. What is the new source of power that you think can carry us through?
Well, we have to shift from using an energy source that requires drawing out of oxygen from the atmosphere and dumps the waste products back into the atmosphere. And that means we're going to have to face the harsh realities of a transition from fossil energy as a driver of our global civilization to the clean solar energy that is available. Alex, it's time to say no to the dark and toxic energy of the underworld. And it's time to say yes and welcome to the pure and sustainable energy of light. It's a bit poetic, this, isn't it? Photodynamics can outpower, outpace, out-resource, and be cheaper than any amount of energy we get from fossil resources. It's time to break out of our bondage to the past. It's time to embrace the freedom of the sun. It's time to usher in the dawn of solar society. By the way, never in the course of human history have so many been trapped in economic bondage to so few. So the breakout is a transformation. And I think that transition from fossil dependency to solar dependency is an extraordinary shift for our whole species. It's a bit like, you know, introducing photosynthesis in the evolution of plants, which could then take solar energy and transform base chemicals into more complex molecules. But today, we are able to take light energy and transform it directly into electricity, power, heat, and light. It's a kind of metamorphosis. I don't see us caught in the death throes of civilization, Alex, merely the demise of an inappropriate mode of civilization. I think we're really experiencing the birth pangs of a new form of humanity. You know, wasn't it that English poet T.S. Eliot who wrote, "Mankind cannot tolerate very much reality"? And time poverty is one of the excuses we use to mask our fear. But thankfully, there's a rapidly growing movement of people around the world who are finding the courage to face the harsh realities of now. And I suppose the video is becoming a catalyst for that momentum. The response has been overwhelming. So it gives me the courage to share a dream of the future. And I'd like to finish with that. It goes something like this, Alex. I have a dream that humanity will break out of its state of denial and find the courage to face the harsh realities of now. I have a dream that as a species, we will look back on this current crisis and celebrate the solutions we were able to put in place and say with pride, that was humanity's finest hour. Alex, that's the dream. Our task is to make the dream come true.
Listeners, you can go to apollo-gaia.org. That's Apollo with one P and two L's and a dash and Gaia, G-A-I-A.org, to watch this free video with David Wasdell. Please spend the time, learn. It may be the most important hour you will spend this month or maybe this year. You can also download the free summary of the video. And of course, I'll put links in my own show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Or you can just Google Face the Harsh Realities of Now, and David's webpage comes right up at the top of the pile. David Wasdell, thank you so much for taking the time to explain this for all of us.
Alex, thank you so much for the opportunity. Go well.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. All I can tell you is that I've heard from over 100 previous scientists interviewed on Radio EcoShock the evidence that David Wasdell adds up for us in this talk. It's sobering, depressing, and maybe, yes, liberating. We can only go forward, if we can, when we know where we are right now. Please help get this message out widely. Share David's video link, this program, your own thoughts and activism. You know, giving up is not an option. I'm your dedicated friend, Alex Smith. My thanks to all those who reached out to support Radio EcoShock this week, the people who tweet and Facebook further than I can. Thank you for being brave enough to listen, and let's meet again next week.
And years, you're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough. Someday you say you'll have your fun when you're a millionaire. Imagine all the fun you'll have in your old rocking chair.
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself. It's later than you think.
What I have to tell is a very grim story indeed.
But it does require that we have a moratorium on any new coal-fired power plants. And over the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to have to phase out those that exist.
What if you knew that every time you flip on your light switch, a mountaintop in West Virginia just blows up?
Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself. It's later than you
back. And that was Judy Collins. I believe we are joined by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello, Phil.
How you doing?
Good.
Stephen, of course, you've written, I want everybody to remember, a book, The Long War on Syria. I don't have it in front of me, but it's... Washington's Long War on Syria.
Yeah.
And I know you've been lecturing about it, and I by the way, I bet you your sales are doing rather good.
Yes, they are.
Because, you know, people write books, and then they dust gathers. But you've been going around, and everywhere I've heard about your speaking, there's been very good attendance, and thank heavens people are taking that book home. Now, on July 11, you wrote a piece titled The Myth of the Kurdish YPG's Moral Excellence. And this can be found at gowans.wordpress.com. I was very appreciative of the piece because you go into the question that has been, I don't think, been adequately answered anywhere else that I'm aware of. You go into the matter of what is the political outlook of this group called the YPG? And I've noticed something, and I'll ask you about address this. The picture of who they are has been changing during this war, the imposed war by outsiders, basically Saudi Arabia, United States, France, others, Canada, of course, bringing up the rear. We keep hearing what we call the Kurdish question, and different people have been identified, but recently there's been a kind of romantic enthusiasm developing, particularly amongst people who pose as leftists, about the YPG. Tell us who they are. What is their ideology?
Yeah. The YPG, I call the PKK, which is somewhat controversial, but the PKK is the...
We love controversy.
...is related to the Kurd Workers Party, which is in Turkey. And Turkey has the largest Kurd population. The Kurds are scattered or divided between mainly Turkey. 50% are in Turkey. About 28% of them are in Iran. 20% are in Iraq. And there's a very small proportion of Kurds that live in Syria and parts of northern Syria. And the PKK operates in Syria as the YPG. And the PKK is branded a terrorist organization by the United States, by the European Union, and by Turkey when it operates in Turkey. And its aims are to establish self-rule for Kurds. However, when it operates in Syria, it's known as the Syrian Democratic Force. And
represents the Enlightenment.
Yes, and I can talk a little bit about that later. I mean, Robert Fisk, I think, once said that the Syrian Democratic Force is neither Syrian nor democratic. But the PKK, and the reason I call the PKK, or the YPG, the PKK, is kind of the same reason I call al-Nusra al-Qaeda, because al-Nusra is al-Qaeda. It's just you know, they've adopted a name to kind of disguise who they are. But I say that the PKK and the YPG are the same thing is because they have the same leader, who is Abdullah Öcalan. They have the top, they're the same top field commander. They have the same goals. They have the same methods. They have the same personnel. So as many as 5,000 Syrian Kurds have died fighting alongside the PKK since the mid-1980s, and nearly all of the YPG's top leaders and battle-hardened fighters are veterans of this decades-long struggle against Turkey. Most of the people in the YPG now have come from Turkey and streamed across the border after the Islamist insurgency began in Syria in 2011. But the ideology of the group is informed by the leader, Abdullah Öcalan, who has kind of led the PKK guerrillas against the Turkish state since 1978, but he has been in prison for some time. He was initially a Marxist-Leninist, but while in prison, he abandoned Marxism-Leninism for the anarchist ideas of the New York-based intellectual Murray Bookchin, who's an anarchist.
Murray Bookchin. He's gone from Marx to Bookchin.
Right. And Bookchin's ideas are essentially that democratic decision-making needs to be decentralized and inclusive. And while in prison, Öcalan adapted Bookchin's ideas to Kurd nationalism.
By the way, if I could interrupt you, one thing crossed my mind, pardon me for this, but he still calls it the same same name, the PKK, but has changed it from Marx to Bookchin.
Yes.
Well, that's dramatic, but and not the name of the party.
Bookchin rejected the idea that his approach was anarchistic. He preferred to call his approach communalism.
Oh, okay. I'll give him that.
And Öcalan has adapted his approach to the Kurd nationalist struggle and has called it democratic confederalism. So the PKK, whether in Turkey or elsewhere, or in Syria, is attempting to establish this kind of self-ruled or a self-rule enclave or an area based on these democratic confederalist ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at its core, it's a nationalist movement in the same way that labor Zionism, which dominated, you know, the Zionist movement until the 1970s, is at its core a nationalist movement, but was based on the same kind of ideas about decentralized communes or the kibbutzim.
Yeah, such people are not interested in borders if they belong to someone else.
Yes. That's true. And so the PKK in Syria, as I said, in 2011, with the reigniting of the Islamist insurgency in Syria, the PKK saw this as an opportunity to seize control of territory in northern Syria to establish self-rule. And they were kind of helped along by the Syrian government because the Syrian government almost immediately withdrew its troops from those areas, so created a vacuum which the PKK could exploit. And PKK fighters from Turkey then streamed into northern Syria to hold this territory. And the Syrian government withdrew its troops because it wanted to redirect troops to the defense of Damascus and Aleppo, also probably to punish Turkey because Turkey was supporting ISIS and the other Islamist insurgents, but also to conciliate the Kurds, to dissuade them from joining the rebels. And the PKK decided it wouldn't join the Islamist rebels, but it did decide that maybe it could do a deal with Washington.
Bingo.
Washington had been talking about, you know, maybe we could partition Syria and adopt a form of decentralization in which different groups each received autonomy within Syria. And they said we could have an area of Syria that was run by the secular government or the current government. We could have an area run by the Islamists, and we could have an area run by the Kurds. Well, that appealed to the PKK. They were very excited about the idea of, you know, dividing Syria into zones, and they would hold the northern part of the zone or the northern part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also understood that the zone would expand to include territory that the Kurds hoped to capture in battle, not only from ISIS, but also from other Arab insurgent groups. So the implication was that the Kurds actually had established three cantons within northern Syria, but those cantons are divided by areas occupied by Arabs, and so that territory would be conquered by the PKK. And it could also extend its territory into other areas which have been traditionally occupied by Arabs and were never occupied by Kurds in the majority.
Yeah, I want to underline that. So that's what they are proposing to this new whatever communal idea, but the communal idea doesn't include Arabs. I mean, I've heard of the Arabs trying to return, and they chased them away.
Yeah, there seems
and
to
they
be.
Are. I mean, that, and I'm really glad you raised the specter of the boon, because people have not. I think you cast a lot of light on the ideology behind the boon, which has a rather nice face, but then it has a strong nationalist one. But they actually claiming with this lovely idea of a communal existence, but it's their communal existence, not for Arabs.
Yes, and it's hard to say exactly what proportion of Syrians are Kurds, but the estimates are about 2 to 6% of Syrians are Kurds.
Isn't it true that also many of them are refugees originally from Turkey?
Yes, exactly. And many of those who are now in the YPG or the PKK who are in northern Syria have come from Turkey.
And were permitted to come into Syria. It is understood that they needed to be protected.
Yes. And so
this is payback for that. No good deed goes unpunished.
Exactly. And now they control about 20,000 square miles of Syrian territory. So that's roughly 17% of the country. But they represent less than 8% of the population. So how is it that this has happened? I mean, obviously, the implication of this is that they're occupying territory that they haven't traditionally occupied. Some Arab civilians Arab Syrians have been saying that they have been forced out of their homes. They've been displaced in the name of rolling back Islamic State. And I should mention that the deal that the PKK has done with Washington is that the PKK would become the tip of the U.S. spear, as they call it.
They use that expression.
Well, others use the expression, the tip of
the spear. The tip of the spear.
But they essentially made a deal which said you need boots on the ground. You need a proxy. Will operate as your proxy in return for recognition and support for a Kurdish-dominated self-rule within northern Syria. In other words, we're going to do a deal with you that resembles the deal the Kurds in Iraq did with Washington to partition
mm-hmm.
Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Which is way
down the road towards accomplishment.
Yes.
And they have taken Iraqi territory. By the way, I mean, just to show the significance, this man, I can never say his three names, but the French philosopher has had a piece in the Globe and Mail saying that the captured territory in northern Iraq in the recent fighting must become part of a new Kurdish state.
Yes. And,
last time I saw him, he was in Libya celebrating the victory.
And the Kurds are doing exactly the same in Iraq, which is taking territory that was never Kurdish in the first place. And now regarding...
They sound like Americans.
Yes. Well, they now regard in Syria, I mean a province of Syria,
mm-hmm.
as part of Kurdistan, although they've only ever represented a minority in many of these areas. Even some human rights groups have been accusing the PKK of preventing Arabs from returning to liberated areas. So they've been driving them out and then preventing repatriation.
Now, we're speaking Stephen Gowans, The Myth of the Kurdish YPG's Moral Excellence, July 11th, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, on your book, Washington's Long War on Syria, underlines something rather important here, and I'm actually a closing part of our interview with you, but only one element in all the names that have tossed around, Nusra, Al-Qaeda, KPK, these guys, only one offers you a Syria intact with a democratic program and an all-inclusive, non-exclusionary state, and that's the government of Syria, right? Doesn't that make them, by the way, the point of the spear for progress in humanity in Syria?
No, exactly. And, I mean, there's so many people who have been looking for some kind of group to support in Syria against the Syrian government, and they've been having difficulty because all of these progressive, you know, liberal, democratic, secular forces that they believed were there are not there. And now it's become obvious that they're not there. So they're looking to the PKK. Maybe that will fill the void. But you think, who are they looking for? They're looking for a force that's non-sectarian, anti-imperialist, socialist, committed to the rights of women and minorities, and they're pro-Palestinian. So who is that? That's the Syria's Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party. But for some reason, that's a group they don't want to support.
You know, no one's so blind as the one who will not see. Stephen Gowans, it's a pleasure talking to you. We're glad you're doing so well with the book, Washington's Long War on Syria. We look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Stephen Gowans. By the way, listening to Stephen, I was reminded of the Ogden Nash poem about the person who wasn't there. He was going down the stair, and he thought someone was there, but he wasn't. And then he says, poem concludes, he wasn't there again today. I wish he'd go away.
Phil, you know, that Stephen Gowans points out in his article that when the Americans want to divide Syria, this is really redivide Syria because, of course, the British and the French
had already done it.
They already did it back in 1920, right?
Lebanon, yeah. The port.
Palestine.
They robbed them, yes, and they robbed them of the. To be a great nation, you pretty much have to have a port. Beirut is the port. And so the French and the British thought it best not to allow Arabs to have a port, a significant ancient civilization. Like with Hong Kong, one day all this will be fixed. I understand in China that you can visit historic sites, and sometimes there's a gap of the artifacts and whatnot, and there's a sign that says, this portion of our historic art was removed by the British imperialist, and one day it will be returned. Which is sums up a lot of Chinese philosophy, which the Nobel Prize winner didn't share. This is the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tomas Lopez of the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses his concern that President Trump's Commission on Election Integrity may be a Trojan horse, established to usher in more restrictive voter suppression laws. Stanley Hiller of the Middle East Crisis Committee, who assesses the effect of Israel's deliberate power blackout imposed on the people of Gaza, as requested by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, and Dr. Susan Rogers of the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who examines provisions in the now-dead second version of the Senate GOP healthcare bill and reflects on the campaign, advocating for a single-payer universal health care system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
British American Tobacco, one of the largest cigarette makers in the world, has threatened numerous governments in Africa, including Kenya and Uganda, for advocating public health measures to limit tobacco consumption. London-based BAT, which is taking over U.S. tobacco giant Reynolds American, sees Africa as a growth market with rising numbers of young people. According to the Guardian newspaper, BAT lawyers in Kenya have filed legal papers opposing anti-smoking regulations and increased taxes. In Uganda, BAT attorneys say the government's Tobacco Control Act is unconstitutional. Many nations in Africa have signed the World Health Organization's Treaty on Tobacco Control and are now developing tobacco regulations. Tobacco kills 7 million people across the globe annually. There currently are an estimated 77 million smokers in Africa, with dramatic increases in smoking expected in Cameroon and Sierra Leone. Thus far, BAT has succeeded in delaying tobacco regulations in Kenya for 15 years. The company is also working to influence Kenya's upcoming parliamentary elections this August. In the face of the Trump administration's cutoff of family planning funding, the international community's drive to provide modern contraception for millions of poor women has fallen behind. 5 years ago, global public health leaders pledged to provide contraception to 120 million women and girls by 2020. But thus far, only 30 million women have received contraception assistance. The global campaign was designed to reduce mortality at childbirth and address concerns over burgeoning population growth in poor nations, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. In a northern Nigerian clinic, midwives provide injectable contraceptives to young women in an area not far from where Boko Haram terrorists operate. The contraceptives prevent women from getting pregnant for up to 4 years. Yet the community clinic in Nigeria may soon close due to the Trump administration's imposition of the so-called global gag rule, which bans U.S. aid to groups that provide abortions. The United Nations Population Fund now faces a $700 million budget deficit, hindering provision of contraceptives to impoverished nations over the next 3 years. The African Union recently held a summit meeting on the issue of surging population growth on the continent. By the end of the century, Nigeria's population could quadruple to 800 million people. Downtown Detroit has a shiny new streetcar transit system funded by large foundations. It's seen by many observers as a sign of a comeback for the Motor City amid a downtown property boom and construction of new sports stadiums. But the privately run transit service ends at the Amtrak station and offers no help to most Detroit residents who don't own cars and find it difficult to travel to jobs in the suburbs. Despite the downtown turnaround, Detroit continues to lose residents. From a peak of 1.8 million in 1950, only 670,000 people remain, mostly African Americans, who live in a city of 139 square miles, the size of Manhattan, Boston, and San Francisco combined. 70,000 Detroit residents have had their water service cut off since 2014, and thousands remain at risk of foreclosure. After years of decline, many Detroit residents have adapted to life without access to cash or credit. As In These Times reports, an informal economy has sprung up through barter, gifts, and time trading, and off-the-books enterprises including beauty salons in basements, auto repair shops in back alleys, and restaurants run out of homes. According to activist anthropologist David Graeber, author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years, bartering has long been a survival strategy when traditional economies fall apart. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Donald Trump's Electoral College victory in the November presidential election surprised most political pollsters and the majority of voters who had supported Hillary Clinton. Clinton won the popular vote by nearly 3 million ballots,
which caused a frustrated Trump to repeatedly make the false claim that 3 to 5 million illegal immigrants had voted for the Democratic candidate. On the basis of this false accusation, designed to provide a rationale for his historic popular vote loss, Trump initiated the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity to investigate alleged fraudulent voting. The commission is chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, and Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach serves as vice chair. Kobach is well known as the architect of voter suppression laws adopted by states across the country, as well as Arizona's infamous anti-immigrant papers please law, SB 1070. On behalf of the commission, Kobach requested voter information from all 50 state governments in late June. However, the request for voters' names, addresses, birth dates, party affiliation, and the last 4 digits of Social Security numbers was refused outright by 19 states, with others unwilling to comply with key parts of the request. Democratic legislators have demanded Kobach be fired, and 4 lawsuits have been filed against the commission for violation of various federal laws. Your reporter spoke with Tomas Lopez, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses his concern that the commission may be a Trojan horse established to usher in more restrictive voter suppression laws for partisan political advantage.
Last fall, both prior to the election and after the election, President Trump made a number of statements about widespread voter fraud being a concern, and then, an actual thing that he alleges happened in last year's election. He claimed that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally in the 2016 presidential election, but I can tell you that there's no evidence to back that up. Our concern is that this commission that has been set up with Kris Kobach as chair, and then also a number of the other leading individuals with a long history supporting voting restrictions, we're worried that what they're going to be doing is trying to justify these claims of widespread voter fraud, and then also forwarding an agenda, we fear, to call for voting restrictions around the country, more aggressive voter purges, and generally take a big step backward in voting rights.
Tell our listeners exactly what is Kris Kobach and this presidential commission asking the state governments for? What type of information are they after?
Sure. So a couple of weeks ago, Secretary Kobach sent a letter to all 50 states that asked them to provide voter data on name, date of birth, the last 4 digits of a Social Security number, felony conviction history, whether or not they voted in elections going back to 2006, a whole ream of information, a lot of which many states don't even allow to be released. This information we now understand, especially after statements that have been made, it seems as if the commission intends to try to compare this giant list that they would get of 200 million American voters if every state produces data to federal government databases to try to come up with some kind of alleged list of potential non-citizens that are on the voter rolls or people registered to vote in multiple states, and use that information to attempt to justify voting restrictions at the federal level.
Tomas, what has been the response of state governments across the country to this request for voter information from Kris Kobach and this commission?
What we have seen is that states have largely rebuffed this request and that they have done so across partisan lines. There are over 20 states that in one way or another have declined either to provide any data at all or have imposed some really tough conditions on the commission before that data is being released. There are some states that are providing data that the state is claiming is not shielded by law. And what we're seeing is that across the political spectrum, election officials are not really happy with this request. And so, yes, you have some Democrats, like you might expect, that are questioning the motives of the commission, questioning why they're asking for this for such personal data. But you also have the Secretary of State of Mississippi come out and tell the commission they could go jump in the Gulf of Mexico. They've exposed an issue that I think touches a nerve for voters, for officials, and for people across party lines.
What are the checks and balances on this commission and their work? If indeed their mission is to further voter suppression across the country, what force in Congress or in civil society in general can challenge that?
One of the things that is important to understand is that this commission does not have subpoena power. This commission can't force the states to do anything, can't force others to do anything. It doesn't have legislative power, but it does have a really big platform by being created by a presidential executive order, by having the imprimatur and the legitimacy that comes from being a presidential commission. You know, this is not something that should be taken lightly. Our concerns, and I think the concerns that voters and election officials are expressing about what this body is doing, they don't come from nowhere. Kris Kobach is getting a lot of attention, but he's not the only person on this commission who gives us concern. Hans von Spakovsky, another member, in many ways is the intellectual godfather of the effort that we've seen in recent years to pass restrictive voting laws around the country. J. Christian Adams is a former Department of Justice attorney who in recent years has brought a series of lawsuits attempting to force states and localities to more aggressively purge voters so that they can, in such a way that you end up taking eligible voters off the rolls. And J. Kenneth Blackwell, the former Secretary of State of Ohio, is somebody who had a long track record when he was running elections in that state of both troubled administration and of putting together rules that made it more difficult for people to cast a ballot.
That was Tomas Lopez, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program. Learn more about challenges to voter suppression laws and the Presidential Commission on Election Integrity by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Israel has conducted 3 military invasions of the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian territory controlled by Hamas since 2008. Gaza has been under an Israeli military blockade since 2006. After Hamas defeated the other major Palestinian political party, Fatah, which exerts some control over the West Bank, though Israel is ultimately in control of both territories. In June of this year, the conflict between the two Palestinian factions escalated. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas asked Israel to impose restrictions on electric power that Israel delivers to Gaza. The situation is truly desperate for the 2 million people living in the third most densely populated geographic area in the world, who are without electricity for most of the day. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Stanley Heller, who founded the Middle East Crisis Committee 35 years ago to address the issues of the Israel-Palestinian conflict and the role played by the U.S. In 2003, he began producing The Struggle, a half-hour weekly video news program that now runs on public access stations from northern Vermont to New Jersey. Heller recently produced his 700th show. Here he discusses the power blackout imposed on the people of Gaza and how his show has broadened its coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in recent years to address relevant environmental concerns.
In the middle of June, the Palestinian Authority, believe it or not, Mahmoud Abbas, its boss, goes to Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, and says, cut the electricity going to Gaza 40%. Now, at this point, Gaza gets all its electricity from Israel. The last power plant that had been bombed by Israel and somewhat restored ran out of fuel, couldn't afford the fuel. And so it stopped. So all the electricity was coming from Israel. Abbas says, cut it back because Hamas is not doing what I want. And Netanyahu did it. Now, of course, he didn't have to. He rarely does anything Abbas wants, but he did this. And so it's pitiful. There's a woman I've interviewed in Nusayrat camp who's been writing that she's got 3 hours of electricity over 2 days. You can't maintain 20th century life, let alone 21st century life, with 3 hours a day, or I guess the average has been 2 hours a day. It's hideous.
So what is there a campaign specifically? Is it targeting Israel? Is it targeting Abbas? What do solidarity activists, what do they think, you know, is the approach that might change this?
There's a very small campaign at this point. Code Pink has had some nice posters, Let Gaza Have Light, and other people have had other slogans and appeals out there. I don't know if there's been any demonstrations. Alice Rothschild, Dr. Alice Rothschild, just had a powerful article in an American news site. She's a doctor. She's been to Gaza, and she knows what happens to hospitals when there's a cutback in electricity. And hopefully this will galvanize some interest.
I mean, there are a lot of solidarity groups in the U.S. And also, you know, groups in Israel that are against the occupation and would support an end to the blockade. Do you see this as a time of, and maybe it has to do with the election of Trump and people having their hands full in the U.S. with so many other more immediate issues? Does it seem like it's more of a lower level of activism around this issue or not?
Well, it seems like a low level of activism around Gaza. I had expected much more. I mean, it's sad, you know, you almost have to see a massacre. I mean, just 3 years ago was this hideous war against Gaza. You know, then that started up. People got into the streets. They did things. You know, it's different. It's not as obvious. It's an experiment, as Gideon Levy has said.
So this is your 700th show, and how many years have you been doing this?
We've been doing the struggle since 2003.
The Middle East Crisis Committee has been around even longer, like 30 years or something, is that right?
More than 30, 35. This would be our 35th year.
Wow.
Come September.
Over those years, do you see, like, everything's sort of the same, or do you see ebb and flow? Do you see different issues coming to the fore over the years, or maybe reverting to certain issues as time goes on? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, it's kind of gotten worse and worse for Palestinians. On the other hand, there's been definite changes in America, particularly among U.S. Jews. You know, it's as if the non-Jews are afraid to touch the issue unless a significant amount of American Jews say it's okay. And that has happened over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, particularly with this group Jewish Voice for Peace, which has a local presence in New Haven, and it is a big national organization now. And that has opened up, let's say, permission for the non-Jews to understand things and see criticism of Israel doesn't necessarily be anti-Semitism. The struggle started about Palestine and moved on to Iraq during the sanctions. Does a lot of environmental news, and things are, you know, as grave as they can be with Trump pretending he can muscle Mother Nature. You know, it sort of comes full circle. There was an incredibly alarming article in New York magazine, and one of the sentences just stood out to me, and it said that within decades it will be impossible for Muslims to do the Hajj because it will be too hot in Saudi Arabia to physically walk and do the Hajj. This is something 2 million Muslims do a year. So our issues of Middle East justice and religion and environment are all coming together.
That was Stan Heller, executive director of the New Haven-based Middle East Crisis Committee and producer of the Struggle TV program. Learn more about the power blackout imposed on the people of Gaza and the work of the Middle East Crisis Committee by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long after it was unveiled on July 13th, the second version of the proposed Senate Republican health care bill to repeal and replace Obamacare collapsed. A total of 4 senators announced their opposition to the legislation, which could only afford to lose 2 votes among the Republicans' slim 52-seat Senate majority. All of the 46 Democrats and two independents had pledged to vote against the measure. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell then moved to a third attempt to make good on the GOP's long-running campaign pledge to repeal President Obama's signature health care legislation. Following the lead of President Trump, McConnell said he was going to move to repeal Obamacare very soon and leave debate over a replacement plan for a future date. But not long after his Plan C was announced, three Senate Republicans declared their opposition to that plan, killing the standalone repeal attempt. In its second version, the Senate Repeal and Replace Plan would have maintained the dramatic cuts to Medicaid, assuring that 15 million Americans would have lost their health insurance by 2026, with millions more losing coverage due to higher premiums without subsidies. An amendment by Texas Senator Ted Cruz would have allowed insurers to offer cheaper policies with few benefits and discriminate against those with pre-existing conditions. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Susan Rogers, an advisor to the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the now-dead second version of the Senate GOP health care bill and reflects on how the current national debate has affected the campaign advocating the adoption of a single-payer, universal health care system that would cover all Americans.
This bill is, I mean, this is as close to health care reform as an elephant is to a mouse. I mean, there is no reform in that bill at all. All it does is it decimates Medicaid in order to subsidize tax benefits to the wealthy. One of the misconceptions about the Affordable Care Act is that that's been the cause for insurance premiums to rise, deductibles to rise, co-payments for care to rise. But all of that started way before the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act did not cause that. It may have perpetuated it and made it happen a little bit faster. But this new bill does not do any change to how health care is delivered. All it does is it provides a way to cut benefits, to provide less coverage to people, so that people end up buying an insurance policy that essentially offers them no coverage. There's a lot of benefits that the Affordable Care Act did do, like allowing children to stay on their parents' policy till they're 26. It required some benefits that needed to be included, such as maternity care, physical therapy, long-term care, a whole variety of things that they've now taken out so that insurance companies don't have to provide this. So what it does is it says it's an insurance policy, but it's really not insuring people, because what they've done is to make it affordable, they've deleted the benefits. And then Medicaid, which is a big provider of health care, they've just decimated, and the number of people who are now going to be uninsured is going to be phenomenal.
Certainly, the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare has focused a lot of national attention on the question of whether or not health care is a human right. And the Republicans certainly, by and large, have come down in opposition to the notion that people have a right to get health care when they're sick. How has this debate, in your view, moved opinion, if at all, in the direction of people around the country now believing that health care is a human right, as it is in most of the other industrialized nations of the world who have a universal health care system of some kind in place?
Yes. Well, PNHP, the Physicians for National Health Program, clearly believe that health care is a right. And like you say, more and more people are believing that, too. But a lot of the country does not, especially the Republicans who are sponsoring this bill. And one of the things that they promote is this argument that the market forces will finally stabilize health care costs and will solve this whole health care problem, and that competition in buying health insurance policies will help lower costs. But it doesn't do that, because that does nothing to what the market allows things to be what the market allows things to cost. If we look at what we pay in this country, for example, for a chest x-ray, we pay maybe 10 times as much as other industrialized countries with a single-payer system. Same thing for everything. A cardiac bypass can cost 3 to 4 times as much here in this country. And it's not any better here than it is elsewhere.
Dr. Rogers, how has all this controversy about Obamacare and now this Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare, how has it contributed or not to strengthening support for a single-payer universal health care system of some kind here in this country?
Yes, I think over the years, the numbers of people who support single-payer has increased. And if you look nationally, it is now the majority of physicians nationally support a single-payer system. And I think there's just a lot of confusion about what single-payer is, which really kind of tempers the support that we should be able to garner. And now the numbers, like I said, the numbers of doctors and non-physicians who are supporting single-payer has increased.
That was Dr. Susan Rogers, a retired Chicago internist and advisor to the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Find more information on the campaign for single-payer universal health care by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Asata Shakur. I believe in living. I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people. I believe in sunshine, in windmills and waterfalls, tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees. I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes. I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life, And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth, sculpting mud bodies in its path. I have seen the destruction of the daylight and seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind and the blind become the blind in one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference. I have been blocked by the lawless. And if I know anything at all, it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all. It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth. I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship steered by tired, seasick sailors can still be guided home to port. Affirmation by Assata Shakur. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Concentration with an intensity that is all-consuming. Second, you notice their boundless energy as they run, wrapped in a cocoon of play. What that teaches us is that young people are bundles of energy, both physical and mental. Why is this important to us? Because our studies reveal that youth are natural conductors of revolutionary energy. Indeed, their very being are suffused in a revolutionary process of transformation as they change from childhood to adulthood. Revolution bubbles in the very bones of the young. And as they change, they spark change in their environments. Indeed, they give life force to social change. In science, when molecules speed up movement, this process changes energy into heat. Similarly, when social movements agitate in static societies, they radiate excitement. They bring heat. Heat is the element that creates the conditions for change. For when we cook, we change raw materials into food we can digest. When we work out and exercise, we turn fat into muscle. And yes, when we have sex, we bring forth new life. That's cooking, ain't it? I think so, right? When we struggle, we cook up social change. If we do it hard enough, hot enough, we make revolution. Total social change can be born. The youth make revolution. They always have and always will. Before I depart, a few words from the great black revolutionary Dr. Frantz Fanon, who worked himself to death on behalf of the Algerian Revolution. Now, because I don't have the text before me, I must try to recount it from memory. He said, "Every generation must, out of relative obscurity, find their destiny and fulfill it or betray it." Dr. Frantz Fanon. So think about that. On the move. Long live John Africa. The youth make the revolution from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
when systems fail. If we're honest, the U.S. is facing serious crises. It is a crisis in leadership and a crisis in government. Indeed, the crisis is spreading like a virus. For years now, conservatives have claimed that government should be led by businessmen. This has especially been so in the case of the U.S. presidency. It has been over 6 months with a businessman at the helm of the ship of state. And what do we see? If we're honest, we must admit it has been a disaster. Government, to the extent that there is one, is largely dysfunctional. It runs hither and yon from one emergency to another, solving no problems and creating many. It insults and demeans allies, as shown perhaps best by Germany's Angela Merkel, who announced that henceforth Europe could no longer rely on the Americans and would go its own way. Insults may sell newspapers, but it alienates friends. Government and business are two different things, and like oil and water, they don't blend well. Millions of Americans believe that one's wealth was a sign of one's wisdom. The late John Kenneth Galbraith, an acclaimed economist, challenged that common belief, noting, "One of the things you must understand about 1929, here he speaks of the Great Depression, is the danger in attributing intelligence to the simple fact that people are associated with large sums of money or large financial institutions. We don't ask whether they're intelligent. We say they're associated with all this money, so they must be intelligent. We attribute intelligence to association with financial operations, and only afterwards do we discover that error and that people involved can be extremely successful in gulling themselves, that they can, in effect, and I use the word advisedly, be marvelously stupid." A lesson from economist John Kenneth Galbraith. Look at where we're at now. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. We'll be right back.
All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. Let's jump right into this. When I was putting the show together, I kept thinking about the dangers facing humanity from the fascist Trump-Pence regime. And that runs from the people dying in the U.S. wars in the Middle East in truly horrific numbers, to the destruction of the planet due to climate change, to the families ripped apart and terrorized by deportations, to the assaults on the rights of women and LGBTQ people, to the nuclear blackmail being carried out in the Korean Peninsula. In each situation, policies that are criminal, inhumane, and really horrible are carried out in the name of lies and false narratives. And if you have listened to my show at all over these years, you know that I bring you the truth, the things that you need to know to understand what's going on, and to be part of fighting for a different future for humanity and the planet. At the back end of the show, I'm going to be rebroadcasting an interview I did with Dr. Bruce Cummings, who takes apart what everybody knows about North Korea and uncovers the real history and truth of U.S. aggression. Bruce Cummings is the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Service Professor in History at the University of Chicago and the author of many books, including The Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. And opening the show up, I'm going to be sharing a talk given by Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books New York, and one of the co-initiators of Refuse Fascism. Now, this talk was given on April 27th during a nationally live-streamed teach-in. Fascism in America, could it happen here? Is it happening here? What's the danger that the Trump-Pence government poses? This event explored, from different perspectives, the essential nature of the Trump-Pence government, the relevance of the history of fascism, the threat it poses to humanity and the planet itself, and the dangers of normalization. You can watch the whole teach-in at refusefascism.org. Andy Z is introduced by Sansara Taylor.
We are going to now move to our last presentation, and we are going to hear from the spokesperson for Revolution Books, which is the intellectual and cultural center of a movement for an actual revolution right here in this country. At the heart of Revolution Books is the new communism that has been developed and forged by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and this bookstore features a wide range of books on philosophy, science, novels, poetry, the arts, history, and more from all around the world. And our next speaker, in addition to being the spokesperson for Revolution Books, is also a co-initiator of this movement, together with others, of Refuse Fascism. Join me in welcoming Andy Z.
Fascism in America. Could it happen here? Yes. Is it happening here? Yes. The call to action of Refuse Fascism begins. The Trump-Pence regime is a fascist regime. Not insult or exaggeration. This is what it is. What is the danger that the Trump-Pence government poses? Nothing less than the fate of the planet and humanity as we know it. This regime has already taken measures which, if allowed to continue much longer, will have devastating effects on the environment. Deadly impact that could take decades to undo if, and that is a big if, repair would even be possible. And should the regime be able to carry out their full plan, the result would be catastrophic. This is not the worst of it, even as it is ethically suspect to quantify just which of the many horrific measures that this regime is taking is actually worse. Nevertheless, the call to action from Refuse Fascism says, quote, because Trump has his finger on the nuclear trigger, the Trump-Pence regime is more dangerous to the world than Hitler. We must be clear. The Trump-Pence regime has already brought the world closer to nuclear war than any time in the last 80 years, according to those who set what is called the doomsday clock. They say it is now 2.5 minutes to midnight. The first 100 days of this fascist regime and the Trump-Pence administration have tripled the number of civilian casualties in the Middle East. Trump launched missiles at Syria while dining at his Florida country club. And the next week, he dropped the biggest non-nuclear bomb made for no other purpose than intimidating the entire world. Now, he is engaged in the most dangerous and thoroughly unjust nuclear blackmail with North Korea. Trump boasted that he would bomb the shit out of them. And he said, if we have nuclear weapons, why can't we just use them? And then there's Vice President Pence, standing on the North Korean border, declaring, we're going to abandon the failed policy of strategic patience. These deadly actions are, on the one hand, a continuation of aggressive and murderous policies carried out by Obama and previous administrations, but they are now supercharged with the strongman imperative of a fascist regime which has riled up its social base to support and to demand that the gloves, such as they were, come off in order to bludgeon the entire world to their vision of making America first. This must be stopped. And to do so will require the most determined struggle. All of you here tonight and those of you watching on live stream, now is the time to stand together, organizing thousands and ultimately millions to, as Refuse Fascism says in its call, to move heaven and earth to drive out this regime. And that this must be a moment in history when millions stand together with conviction and courage, overcoming fear and uncertainty, to resist and say no, not just for ourselves, but in the name of humanity. So as Sansara said, I'm Andy Z. I'm one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism and the spokesperson for Revolution Books. I'm also an advocate for the new communism developed by the revolutionary leader Bob Avakian. But before I dig in, I want to thank the other speakers for coming out tonight, for sharing your work and your insights, and I want to thank all of you for coming out and being a part of this program. Let tonight spark 10,000 conversations. And let tonight have those conversations be the basis upon which you go out and talk to many other people to act according to what you learned tonight. If you got a diagnosis of cancer, I hope you would do everything possible to drive it from your body. Radiation, chemo, changing your whole life so as to live. Does fascism, a societal cancer, require less? We face an emergency, and we face it now. Again, from Refuse Fascism's call, quote, fascism has direction and momentum. Dissent is piece by piece criminalized. The truth is bludgeoned. Group after group is demonized and targeted along a trajectory that leads to real horrors. Hasn't this already begun? Instilling fear and impacting and destroying lives, immigrant lives, Muslim lives, refugee lives, Mexican and Latino lives, black lives, and in a very real sense, ultimately the lives of people here and around the world. 48-year-old Romulo Alviuca Gonzalez lived in the U.S. for decades. He dropped his teenage daughters off at school. ICE waited, then they pounced. Romulo is ripped away from his families. There are hundreds more stories. The Trump-Pence Attorney General Jeff Sessions, standing on the border with Mexico, a hellscape, he called it. He drawled with his sickening plantation master sneer. He said that this is, quote, a new era to rid American cities and the border of the filth brought on by the drug cartels and criminal organizations, employing Nazi language of demonization to terrorize immigrants and refugees and to mobilize a fascist base. And be clear, the word filth has real meaning to fascists. And this, after Jeff Sessions moved to rip up the consent decrees with racist, brutal police forces around the country, he was calling then for the police to be unhampered in terrorizing blacks and Latinos in the inner cities. And John Kelly, General John Kelly, head of Homeland Security, is rapidly moving to completely militarize the border, expanding and unleashing ICE squads around the country, declaring that any and everyone in the U.S. illegally is subject to deportation. This is terror, and this we must stop. Look, deportation is not new. President Obama set a record deporting 3 million human beings. And let's get one thing straight. No human being is illegal, okay? But the Trump-Pence fascist regime is not just continuing mass deportations on an enhanced steroid program, but their very arbitrariness, combined with saying and meaning that every and all immigrants are suspect, while ramping up the militarized repressive ICE apparatus, and at the same time fighting to lock down U.S. borders with the wall and the travel ban, is the road to a different society. It is a fascist zeitgeist, and it will be a fascist law with horrific consequence. The demonization of the refugee and the immigrant, filth, criminals, rapists, stealing our jobs, Muslims, by definition terrorists, all this is the cutting edge of a whole fascist package of Make America White. Unfolding this piece by piece, acculturating people to accept this and turn their eyes away from those groups targeted, and even more ominously, to prepare the country for even greater atrocities to rain down in bombs and war against the people from Africa, where the administration has loosened the rules of military engagement to the Mideast. This is fascism. And if we had the time, we could make the case for the same kind of transformations and vicious programs that are aimed against women, black people, LGBTQ persons, and the existential danger that this regime poses for the planet and all of its species. If you are concerned about, if you are fighting back on any of these fronts, understand that these battles are not now living in a more favorable time because the people are aroused against Trump, but that these fights need to be waged as a whole with a unifying theme of driving out this regime. Because as fascism consolidates, there will be less and less ground to fight on, and it can become too late. As we approach the 100th day of this regime, the question is not, as the mainstream liberal media and the Democrats present it, how little Trump has accomplished in his 100 days. The essence of it is the matter is how much, how far, how draconian are the things he's already done and where this will lead if not stopped, and stopped soon. Everyone who sees the scale and the scope of what this regime has done and are doing must hammer at this everywhere you go. The Trump-Pence regime is doing that. Every day, they jump from one outrage in word and deed to another, from dropping bombs to terrorizing communities while careening from one lying and threatening tweet and outrageous press conference to another. It's dizzying, and that is an integral part of the method to their madness. Through the sheer, unrelenting, outrageous horrors, people are becoming inured, and the madness gets normalized. From the Refuse Fascism Call to Action. The Trump-Pence regime from day one has been, quote, subverting the separation of powers, the separation of church and state. The regime has called for a new nuclear arms race. It has demonized the press. It has dismissed the very concept of truth, substituting their own fabricated alternative facts. And most important, fascism is not just a gross combination of horrific reactionary policies. It is a qualitative change in how society is governed.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're listening to a talk given by Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books New York, and one of the co-initiators of Refuse Fascism.
So what is the essence of this qualitative change? And here I quote from the website revcom.us, the website of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The quote is this, quote, "Fascism is the exercise of blatant dictatorship by the capitalist imperialist ruling class, ruling through reliance on open terror and violence, trampling on what are supposed to be civil and legal rights, wielding the power of the state and mobilizing organized groups of fanatical thugs to commit atrocities against masses of people, particularly groups of people identified as enemies, undesirables, or dangers to society. At the same time, and this can be seen in studying the examples of Nazi Germany and Italy under Mussolini, that while it will likely move quickly to enforce certain repressive measures in consolidating its rule, a fascist regime is also likely to implement its program overall through a series of stages and even attempt at different points to reassure the people or certain groups among the people that they will escape the horrors if they quietly go along and do not protest or resist while others are being terrorized and targeted for repression, deportation, conversion, prison, or execution." End quote. Isn't this what is unfolding before our eyes? Trump and Pence, Sessions and Kelly, they've advocated for and begun the remaking of the police apparatus and, yes, the law. "Be forewarned," said Jeff Sessions, "this is a new era. This is the Trump era. Millions of black youth have been the targets of a slow genocide through mass incarceration. And before being locked up, they are confined in cities under intense police pressure with no way to survive but to fight each other over petty turf. And now comes the Trump-Pence regime to take the gloves off, including the threat to send in the feds to Chicago. Trump has unleashed rabid, fascist, racist thugs who have been organizing to do bloody street battle, now focused in Berkeley. And know this, there is no contradiction between fascism coming to power through elections and the mobilizing of a militia outside the direct control of the state. Again, the essence of fascism as a form of rule of a capitalist society is blatant dictatorship. That when it is fully imposed will mean the virtual elimination of basic democratic rights, including the right to dissent, and such change is most definitely now afoot. To be clear, democratic rights have always been severely limited and curtailed for whole sections of the people, starting with the foundation of this country, in the genocide of the native peoples and in slavery, and the continuing legacy of brutality since, and increasingly so in recent years, with 2.3 million incarcerated and 3 million people deported by Obama. And there has always been vicious repression and suppression against anyone who mounts a serious challenge to the system and who has a grounding among the masses. But fascism, what the Trump-Pence regime are preparing to bring down on society, is on a whole other level. So how did we get here? Trump's election surprised many, maybe even him. But the reality is that the fascist movements that he has cohered within and back and who are backing him and have been unleashed by his regime have been developing for decades. The Republican Party itself has basically been fascist for decades, hollowed out in a virulent vehicle for the assertion of white supremacy, patriarchy, and a program of punishment, with a dominant and driving faction within the Republican Party being a highly political and organized form of Christian fundamentalism, more accurately described as Christian fascism. These Christian fascists have been organizing within and are a major political force in the military. Mike Pence, DeVos, Rick Perry, Ben Carson, these are all creatures of this movement. You might think that Donald Trump, a lifelong vile sexual predator, and this Christian fundamentalist movement are complete opposites. But what they share is a thoroughly misogynist view of women, an outlook and horrific practices that objectify, degrade, control, brutalize, and even cost women not only the ability to live full lives as people, but potentially even their very lives. And driving the rise of this fascism have been major changes and challenges in the international situation, in the global economy, and changes in the legitimizing norms of this country, that is, its cohering values and morality. And there is fierce struggle over this at the top levels of society, between different sections of the ruling class, and then all the way down through every social group and every class in society. Underlying this is a situation where the U.S., the dominant and sole superpower in the world today, faces a very fraught situation of challenges to its hegemony. The U.S. wars and occupations in the Middle East have not produced a decisive victory, and reactionary Islamic fundamentalism has gained ground and influence in the Mideast and North and South, North and Sub-Saharan Africa, and in Central Asia and Indonesia. Globalization and the new technology, the entry of and dependence on women into the workforce, have further undermined the traditional and social political formations that, for one thing, have formed the traditional base of the Democratic Party since FDR. These divides have brewed since the 1960s, and in an important dimension are the product of and the backlash against the 1960s. Bob Avakian, in a prescient 1998 essay, The Truth About the Right-Wing Conspiracy and Why Clinton and the Democrats Are No Answer, and for those younger people, that refers to Bill Clinton. This essay goes into the roots and the development of the divide between the Christian fascists and the Democrats, taking apart how the changed international alignments, the underlying stresses and strains and transformations in the global economy, as well as within U.S. society, fueled on the one hand this Christian fascist movement's drive to forcibly reassert traditional American values, first of all, of white supremacy, in an economy where there is no future for the millions of black youth, which has resulted in massive levels of mass incarceration. And second, the forcible imposition of patriarchy, which has been a driving force of the Christian fascist movement. All of this has been fueled by these underlying dynamics. And as women have come into the workforce and their traditional subservient roles of morality have, in the eyes of these Christian fascists, been undermined by birth control and the right to abortion and the lifting of women's sights through the struggle of the women's movement, all of this is seen as something that of grave threat to what they see as the coherence of America. And yet, on the other side, the Democrats came to represent a multicultural, inclusive vision of America. But, and this is really important, they have no vision or program that is not severely constrained by the very limits of the needs of the system to compete in a changed and fraught world, one where there is no longer a basis for the massive social programs and where the preservation of their system requires that the roots of patriarchy and of white supremacy be left mainly intact. Much of what remains for the masses of people who are cast aside is prison, punishment, or drugs. The Democrats have always seen these Christian fascists as a necessary part of the mix, and they are extremely reluctant to call their base out to confront these Christian fascists. Nor will they call their base, this multicultural base, out into the streets, as they were in the 1960s, for fear of where that almost led. And as I said, the Democrats have no real answers to any of the terrible problems that face society because of the constraints of the capitalist imperialist system today in this country. This is why only the massive struggle of the people can be relied upon to stop fascism and to drive out this regime. So it is against this background and to resolve these contradictions that Trump was able to cohere an already existing and developing fascist movement. This whole brew of contention, which took a leap under Obama, then became an occasion through which this base saw themselves right up against it. And some of the core fascists who got behind Trump and who are now around Trump, including Rudolph Giuliani, saw in Donald Trump their, quote, last chance to cohere a new fascist order. So look, there's a lot more to say, and we need to get into our discussion. And in conclusion, I want to underscore two key implications of the reality we face in this fascist regime. And these two points are what unites Refuse Fascism. And let me say also that in Refuse Fascism, we have or should have diverse views as to analyses and ultimate strategies and visions of what kind of future we want. I've put forward my view tonight. There are other views. But what we are united around is the single unifying mission of driving out this regime. Because it is an emergency, and it's an emergency for humanity, because it's fascism. And second, our call to action says, don't normalize, don't accommodate, don't conciliate, and don't collaborate. No, Bernie Sanders, we must not work with this regime. If you do, you normalize the road to horror. No, Indivisible, this is not a pendulum swing, and channeling resistance into 2018 is, and I quote from our call, folly, betraying a lack of understanding of just how fast and furious and profoundly this regime will change the rules, cement its rule, and destroy lives and crush spirits. So those who say calling this fascism is premature, I say no and yes. No, history has shown that fascism must be stopped before it becomes too late. And I'll say yes, but only in this sense. Now is the time to prevent this fascist regime from fully consolidating by driving it out. This is a fascist regime. This is a serious diagnosis. It is an emergency. And I don't come to you as someone who has thought for a minute that this system before Trump was anything but an unending horror for the majority of humanity. And I work for the day when it can be ended. But I am here today to say that if it is indeed true that the doomsday clock is 2.5 minutes before midnight, if it is indeed true that group after group is already and will be demonized, assaulted, and cast aside, if it is indeed true that the very ability of people to speak out and to stand up and to fight back and to struggle for a better world could be severely diminished should this regime move to full-out fascism, then we need to get organized and act with determination like never before. Each of us must put a lot on the line. There is no business as usual. There is no protest as usual. The Trump-Pence fascist regime must be driven from power, and no one but the people are going to create the conditions where that becomes possible. No, it is not how things have usually gone in this country, but there is nothing usual about what we face. We must organize now with all the creativity and determination we've got to prepare for a time when millions of people can be moved to fill the streets of cities and towns day after day and night after night, declaring this whole regime illegitimate, demanding and not stopping until the Trump-Pence regime is driven from power. This is what can shake up the whole country, where every faction within the established power structure would be forced to respond, and where it could lead to a situation where this fascist regime is driven from office. Think of the kind of struggle that took place in Tahrir Square in Egypt, or what took place in Seoul, South Korea, just this past winter. So reflect on everything you've heard tonight, and then get involved. Join Refuse Fascism. Get your organization or your group together, and join together with us to drive the regime out. Fight every battle that needs to be fought, but have all those battles be part of and contribute to a massive struggle as soon as is possible to gather in cities across this country to stop this regime. Resolve that after tonight, that you will do your part so that this becomes a moment in history, as we say in our call, when millions stand together with conviction and courage and overcoming fear and uncertainty to resist and say no, not just for ourselves, but in the name of humanity. So thank you, and let's get to it.
All right, that was Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books, New York City, and one of the co-initiators of Refuse Fascism. This talk occurred during a teach-in on April 27th called Fascism in America. Could it happen here? Is it happening here? What's the danger that the Trump-Pence government poses? Again, the entire teach-in can be seen at refusefascism.org. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Decisions from Outer National. Now, I'm very pleased to be bringing on to the show Bruce Cummings. Bruce is a person who has spent his life studying Korea, and in particular North Korea and what's going on between North Korea and the rest of the world. We're talking with Bruce on the real history of U.S. relations with North Korea, which has been a history of nonstop U.S. aggression. Bruce is the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Service Professor in History at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of many books, including The Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil and The Truth About North Korea and Syria. So let's just jump into it. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Back in late March, you wrote a piece titled, This is What's Really Behind North Korea's Nuclear Provocations. And you opened it up with a description of Trump having dinner with the Japanese prime minister, and that the dinner was disrupted by news that North Korea had fired off a new solid-fuel intermediate-range ballistic missile, and it was aimed towards Japan. Now, this was a huge thing in the news everywhere. There was a message in the missile that you pointed to. Let's talk about that.
Well, it was a very pointed message because Prime Minister Abe, having dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Trump, is the grandson of one of the most powerful Japanese leaders and politicians in the mid-20th century, Kishi Nobusuke. And in the 1930s, he was manufacturing munitions in the puppet state of Manchukuo, northeast China, or Manchuria, as we knew it at the time. And Kim Il-sung, who is, of course, the grandfather of the current North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, was fighting really for a decade against the Japanese in Manchuria. So that history, which is still very alive for both the Japanese and the North Koreans, is nonetheless hardly known at all in this country. The U.S. declared Mr. Kishi to be a Class A war criminal during our occupation of Japan after the war. He spent time in jail. But when he got out, the U.S. supported him to the hilt. He was one of the founders of the Liberal Democratic Party, which is the major party in Japan, a country that's had a kind of one-party rule going back to 1955 when the LDP was founded, I might add, with a lot of CIA money. And then Kishi was prime minister in the late 50s twice. So suddenly he goes from American enemy in World War II to big American friend. And the current Prime Minister Abe really reveres his grandfather. So the North Koreans made a very pointed comment just by the timing of this particular missile, But they did it again on Memorial Day. Nobody in this country ever points it out. I mean, they blew off an atomic bomb on Memorial Day during President Obama's first few months in office, and they launched a missile toward Japan on Memorial Day, the one we just had. So the North Koreans must have at least some aggravation that nobody seems to get their messages.
When it comes to nukes and nuclear weapons and the situation in North Korea versus South Korea, and of course, standing in there, and really the principal character in a lot of this is the U.S. and what they've actually been orchestrating for decades now, many decades. And one of the things that you say in your part of the book, Inventing the Axis of Evil, the Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria, you argue that the U.S., in fact, today, when it's talking about all this stuff around the North Koreans are terrorizing people, there's news that they've just fired off another missile down towards Japan and all this stuff, and it's really making it seem like they're just frothing at the mouth and raring to go. You make a point in your book that I thought was important for people to understand, and it's something that never does ever come out, which is that the United States terrorized North Korea with nuclear weapons during and after the Korean War, and was the only power to introduce nuclear weapons to Korean soil. So there's a lot that's just unknown by people, even as they sit there and are fed all this stuff about how the North Koreans are crazy and they're playing with nukes. And here you have the U.S. as being actually the progenitor of all this.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit like the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where most people, including a lot of liberals, accepted the fact that Saddam Hussein was a vicious dictator who had WMDs. And there was no real background given to, for example, our support of Saddam Hussein in the 1980s in the war with Iran. Then we have a war, and the war goes very badly. It's still a complete catastrophe. And all this history comes out. And if we were to go to war with North Korea, which has seemed closer under the Trump administration than it has been in some time, all of this would come out about the U.S. running an operation called Hudson Harbor in 1951, where B-29s dropped dummy atomic bombs on North Korea to see whether they might be useful against troop concentrations in cities. President Eisenhower, toward the end of the war in May 1953, tested one of the largest atomic bombs ever tested and also shot the first atomic cannon. And this was all put on front page of newspapers and was intended to bring an end to the war and intimidate North Korea and China. And then, as you said, in 1958, we installed hundreds of nuclear weapons, battlefield tactical weapons, and short-range warheads on missiles into South Korea. So we're the first one to introduce nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula and kept them there until 1991, when they were withdrawn on a world scale because the Pentagon felt that precision-guided high explosives, but non-nuclear weapons, would cause fewer problems. You wouldn't have radiation and collateral damage from nuclear weapons. So we drew them back. But you can leave it to Donald Trump to tell you what the North Koreans still face, for example, a Trident submarine, sometimes called Armageddon, in one sausage tube. He mentioned that two of our nuclear submarines, were off of North Korea last week. This is, of course, classified information. He's not supposed to say that. He doesn't know that, but the fact is that one of our nuclear submarines, or all of them, could run right up to the North Korean coast and obliterate North Korea in a matter of hours. Colin Powell, back in 1995, which should give your listeners an idea of how long this problem has been going on. It's really 25 years we've been dealing with the North Korean nuclear problem. Colin Powell said if they ever used a nuclear weapon in anger, the U.S. would turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette. I just want to say one more thing about that. If you imagine North Korea as the green team against the blue team rather than the evil Kim Jong-un with his crazy haircut against the always perfect United States, you can see what they're up against. It's a small country, and the largest power in the world is constantly threatening it with nuclear annihilation. President Obama did this, too. He routinely sent nuclear-capable B-1 and B-2 bombers over South Korea for exercises. So it's a very dangerous situation, and I think it's incumbent upon Americans to put themselves in the shoes of the North Koreans and look at the world that they face, quite apart from all of our media stereotypes about how crazy they are and how dangerous they are.
Which brings us right to this, too, because when you want to talk about crazy and dangerous, you say that the North Korea, would not have had nukes if the U.S. had actually kept its word in the past.
people who follow this situation closely and high officials in the Clinton administration, like Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Wendy Sherman, her very close aide on North Korea, have written about this. Bill Clinton nearly struck North Korea with a preemptive attack against their nuclear facility in June 1994. It was only later that people realized or came to understand how close we were to a war with North Korea at that time. But Jimmy Carter intervened when he heard about all of this. He flew to Pyongyang and talked directly with Kim Il-sung and got a freeze on all of North Korea's plutonium. It's very important to underline that that freeze was completely monitored and checked for 8 years, 24/7. You had UN inspectors on the grounds, closed-circuit cameras watching it at all times. The reactors were sealed. And, of course, we know with our intelligence when a reactor starts up. So there's no question the North Koreans didn't have an ounce of plutonium from 1994 to 2002. However, George Bush had already put North Korea in his axis of evil in 2002, and then in September he announced his preemptive doctrine, which the euphemism was anticipatory self-defense, and North Korea, along with Iran and especially Iraq, were listed as the countries for which this policy was developed. He then went ahead, of course, to invade Iraq in March of 2003, which was really a preventive war rather than anticipatory self-defense. I mean, we don't need to get into this, but Saddam Hussein was actually writing a novel at the time and trying to do everything he could not to provoke the U.S. After that happened, North Korea just said as openly and loudly as it could, Saddam Hussein didn't have nuclear weapons. If he had them, he wouldn't have been overthrown. That's not going to happen to us. And they systematically began building. They got back their plutonium, kicked out the inspectors, and systematically began building atomic weapons and tested the first one just 3 years later in 2006. I don't think it's a partisan judgment, but a factual statement to say that George W. Bush has two enormous catastrophes on his hands. One is the invasion of Iraq, which basically wrecked the Middle East since 2003. And second, he is the primary person responsible for North Korea getting nuclear weapons. And I think many experts believe that. Madeleine Albright has written about that. But it doesn't get out in the media at all, in part because so many of our people want to say, well, it's six of one, half dozen of the other, or not to sound partisan.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author, and he's at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. Bruce, let me ask you this. As we're talking about this, basically it seems to be a fact that the U.S. has not paid any attention at all to what the North Koreans have actually done in relation to all the various agreements around missiles and nukes. It seems like they just keep steamrolling in a way to push in a certain direction. They're just going to go after North Korea to take it out.
Well, that is generally true of more recent administrations, but the Clinton administration, after toying with the idea of attacking North Korea, as I said, froze their nuclear facility for 8 years, and then from 1998 to 2000, William Perry, Clinton's former defense secretary, became a kind of roving ambassador for North Korea, and along with South Korea, whose president, Kim Dae-jung, had started an engagement policy with North Korea. For 2 years, you had talks on a whole host of subjects, ending the Korean War, getting rid of their plutonium once and for all, and basically buying out their medium and long-range missiles indirectly. This was a terribly important agreement that was signed, in effect, in October 2000, when a very high North Korean general, Cho Myung-nok, who was responsible for their conglomerate that builds their missiles, came to the White House, met with Bill Clinton, Cho having his full military regalia on, and they signed an agreement saying neither country would have hostile intentions toward the other. And if Clinton would go to Pyongyang to meet with then-leader Kim Jong-il, North Korea would mothball its missiles and enter the missile technology control regime, which would limit their missiles to 300 kilometers. Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State at the time, then went to North Korea in late October, met with Kim Jong-il to work on this deal. But then, of course, we had the 2000 election, and for 6 weeks we didn't know who was going to be president. And when the Supreme Court gave it to George Bush, his people said they didn't like that agreement. You can just read Madam Albright's memoirs to see how flabbergasted she was by that, because North Korea would not have the missiles that they keep blowing off if we had followed through on that agreement. I mean, the Bush administration, the W. Bush administration, really has a lot to answer for, not only in allowing North Korea to get hold of its plutonium again, but in allowing this missile deal to drop between the stools. Now, Obama was better in the sense that he did try to initiate talks with North Korea in 2012, but he also put North Korea kind of on the back burner among the countries, pariah states, let's say, that he wanted to open relations with, Cuba, Burma, Iran, and even Laos. And he never got around to North Korea. And as I said before, he also frequently lofted these B-1 bombers over the South just to let the North Koreans know who's boss.
One of the things, though, that you talk about, too, in this number of articles, where you talk about most recently the use of agreements, et cetera, have been kicked to the curb, that there's an assumption that no one has been able to rein in the nuts in North Korea and their nuke program, and it's time to fight or topple. Let's talk about that.
People routinely say North Korea has always cheated and never has kept to its agreements. And I don't know where they're coming from because it's simply not true. In addition to the plutonium agreement, the freeze, and the missile deal, North Korea in 2000 also opened relations with many of our allies. So they have diplomatic relations with Canada and Great Britain, France, Germany, Italy. We're one of the last countries not to have relations with North Korea, still trying to isolate it. But the fact is North Korea was really reaching out, and then they faced a wall of hostility from Bush. It is true that if we continue to intimidate North Korea with nuclear weapons and bring them into the theater by submarines and air power, anybody in North Korea would get a deterrent. In that sense, the critics of North Korea are right that North Korea, when it felt intimidated over many, many years, eventually developed nuclear weapons. It might have happened anyway, but the fact is we did have agreements with them that kept them from moving to nuclear weapons. Finally, I would say, in response to your question, that the discourse about North Korea under Trump has just been absurd in that Trump, as I said, talked about our nuclear submarines off the coast. He has threatened North Korea. He's also said he'd like to talk to Kim Jong-un over a hamburger. That might be the better way to go. But he's so erratic, and the one thing that the North Koreans notice is the submarines, the two aircraft carrier task forces that are in Northeast Asian waters right now. What Trump has done privately or secretly and what the Pentagon has done is just jam a bunch of hardware up against North Korea. Meanwhile, our press, and that includes not Fox News but CNN and MSNBC, are constantly running scare stories about North Korea. I saw on CNN that Anna Navarro, one of their frequent commentators, even referred to Kim by his first name, saying little boy Un is a maniac. She probably thought that was his last name, but that's the level of discourse that we've had about North Korea under Trump.
And related to that, you've pointed out that North Korea is the only country in the world to have been systematically blackmailed by U.S. nukes going all the way back to the 50s. When you're looking at this, all these other places that have developed some form of nuclear weaponry or are trying to get it, or and then the main focus is on North Korea. Why?
That generalization wouldn't have held up if we looked at China in the 50s and early 60s before they got nuclear weapons. We were doing the same thing to China, intimidating them, blackmailing them, that we did to North Korea and nearly got into a war over some tiny islands in 1958 with China. You might also say that Iran has been similarly intimidated, but we have not been close to war with Iran, nor have we fought a war with Iran. But with North Korea, we fought a bloody war for 3 years. We've had 72 years of conflict with them going back to the initial American occupation of Southern Korea in 1945. And China, once it got its own nuclear weapons, of course, we weren't in a position to do much about that. It creates a kind of Mexican standoff for nuclear deterrence. But with North Korea, we really have just decades of threatening this small country with nuclear weapons, and why should we be surprised when they finally want to get a deterrent of their own?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author, and he's at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. Related to that, you have something like Leon Panetta's statement that we have been within an inch of war with the North Koreans for many months. And so then he advocated dropping these dummy bombs. This seems to be a constant edge of the North Koreans are actually living on the edge of what could be massive incineration and unbelievable havoc being wreaked on the Korean people.
If there were a a new war in Korea, it would extend to Japan and all of our military bases in the region, including Guam, where we have huge installations and hundreds of bases in Japan and South Korea with almost 80,000 troops on the ground in Japan and South Korea, American troops. They would all be targeted by the North Koreans, and the North Koreans wouldn't win this war, but they would absolutely devastate the region. And that's why there is no military solution to the problems in Korea. There never has been, as we learned in the Korean War when it ended in a stalemate. Leon Panetta's statement is particularly worrisome because it was during the Obama administration. He told CNN in 2011, just as you said, we'd been within an inch of war with North Korea for months on end. And this went back to 2010 when there were skirmishes in the, what Koreans call the West Sea and everybody else calls the Yellow Sea on the western midriff of the Korean Peninsula. There are clashes there all the time, particularly in May and June when the crabbing season begins and North and South Korean fishing boats get into conflict with each other. There's also a northern limit line in the sea that the U.S. And South Korea recognize, but North Korea has never recognized it. And Henry Kissinger, when he was Secretary of State, said it was totally illegal under international law. So you don't have a demilitarized zone or a line that everybody recognizes. Instead, you have a kind of free-for-all there. And in 2010, it escalated to the point where the North Koreans took out a South Korean ship, a naval ship, and killed more than 30 of their sailors. And that ratcheted up the tension a great deal, and it's what led in 2011 to Panetta's statement. But it's absolutely ridiculous to imagine a general war in the region breaking out because of crabbing ground conflicts and a situation in the sea there that should long ago have been resolved. Getting a North Korean agreement to where their boats can go and where South Korean boats can go.
So you've also made a point, and I think this is really important, that there's a whole different perception of the problem, the source of danger in relation to nukes in Korea. And it's sort of that, you know, there's an epistemology that sort of is always bad no matter when it's used, which is based on everybody knows, you know, and that is a very dangerous thing in relation to this. In reality, there's a long history, as you've been saying, to nuclear threats against North Korea itself. In fact, the U.S. has recently installed the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. Let's talk about those two things.
Well, that was one of the more cynical ploys on the part of the United States in recent years. This terminal high altitude area defense system was jammed into South Korea while the current president, at the time President Park Geun-hye, was being impeached, and before the election that was held earlier this month, which brought a progressive to power. And the U.S. fears that Moon Jae-in, the new president, will be an engager of North Korea, like his mentor, Nomu-hyun, who was president from 2002 to 2007. And so they wanted to get that system in and installed before the new president came into office. And he just complained last week that four launchers were brought in without his permission or without his office being notified about that. In other words, we are continuing to add to the system even after he's president without telling him. It's just an outrageous situation in our relationship with South Korea. We hardly ever have problems with the ruling party that goes back to the dictators, but we always have problems with liberals and progressives who want to try a different approach toward North Korea. The only time that has not been true is when Bill Clinton and William Perry brought American policy around to engagement for 2 years, 1998 to 2000. That's the only time we've had direct talks with the North Koreans that have really yielded so much. But I would expect that President Trump is not going to like President Moon very well, and you'll see a lot of tension in their relationship, just as there was between George W. Bush and Nomu-hyun in the early 2000s. I want to say one more thing about THAAD system. It's really designed not to knock down North Korean missiles. North Korea has short and medium-range missiles that it can launch by the dozens, and there's no way this THAAD system could knock them down. It's really there to monitor North Korean long-range missiles and Chinese missile tests and long-range missiles, and the Chinese have complained mightily about this. I think the THAAD system's installation in South Korea was primarily political in that it was trying to get it in there before a progressive president was elected and to do what the U.S. has been trying to do for many, many years, which is to weld South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. together in an alignment or an alliance to contain China. it doesn't really have much to do at all with the so-called North Korean threat, but it has a lot to do with off China and, you know, making sure the system's in there before a president comes to power who might not like it.
One more question, Bruce. Just how dangerous is this situation, both in terms of war and even the impact of war on human survival?
Well, I'm in touch with 30 or 40 people who work on North Korea, former government officials, scholars. Somehow North Korea has become a big deal. We have 15 or 20 websites dealing with it now that we never had 10 or 15 years ago. But in the last couple of months, I've seen time and again very well-informed experts worrying about the U.S. and North Korea coming to blows. It could come from an incident that ratchets up into a war, or it could come from a preemptive attack. And there was a great deal of talk back in March and April about Trump people favoring a preemptive attack on North Korea on its missiles. You can't really attack their nuclear facilities preemptively, or you'll loosen a hell of a lot of radiation around the region. There was almost a consensus inside the Beltway in the fall and winter that if North Korea keeps moving toward an ability to hit the United States with a long-range missile and a nuclear weapon, we just have to think about preempting that. And it's very, very dangerous because along the DMZ there have been cycles of preemption and counter-preemption both happening and envisioned by the respective militaries, North and South Korea and the U.S., going back decades, going back to the Korean War. So to add the threat of a preemptive attack on North Korea's missiles is just to really come close to bringing forth the general war in the region that we talked about.
All right, Bruce Cummings, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. And we've been talking about what the hell the U.S. is doing in relation to North Korea and what danger does it pose for the Korean people and for humanity as a whole. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank everybody who helped on the show this week. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my guests, Bruce Cummings and Andy Z. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Voice of Revolution from Savage Rose. Talk to you next week. Children